All right, we're live. All right, ladies and gentlemen, Vinny Shorman, how are you, buddy?
Hello, I'm fine. How are you?
Good, good. Pull that mic up, right up, get it right up there. There
okay.
We just did a hypno session. How would you call it? Hypnotic session?
Just say it's a session.
Hypnosis?
Really. Yeah.
Just a session.
Stuff.
Mental
mind
training,
stuff.
Mind stuff.
Yeah.
Vinny is the man that Joe Schilling had experienced some fantastic results doing this with you. Joe Schilling, who's the world champion kickboxer and Bellator fighter, guy who's been in here before. And he told me about you, and you and I went back and forth on Twitter and email, and then we finally got together today and did a hypnosis session. And I'm here to tell you, hypnosis is real. It does. You definitely go under. There's something happens. You go to some weird dream state, la la land. How long was I under for?
4.5 days.
Whoa,
no, you.
I'm even hungry.
To be honest, about I'd say 20 minutes.
20 minutes.
Maybe 20 minutes, 30 minutes. Yeah, I kind of get lost in it too. You know.
It seemed like 5.
No, it was longer than that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was longer than that.
It was like I remember the beginning part, and then all of a sudden it was over. I was like, whoa. And there was some weird dream state stuff going on in the middle where you were talking about some things, but I was thinking about other shit. But when I was thinking about shit, I was like, wow, I'm in a weird state of mind right now while I'm thinking about these other things. Like, I better get back to on track about what Vinny's talking about.
Well, you know, I think it's funny because I've done it. Everything that I do with my clients and you've experienced, I've experienced, and you put it right. Yeah, it is weird.
Yeah.
But it's weird because it works. Definitely works.
Well, there's different states that the brain operates in. We all know that. There's states when you're stressed out. There's states when you're super happy. There's states when you're very focused. There's states when you're in danger. There's states when you're in love. And we all know that these are weird places that your brain can go to, weird frequencies or weird vibrations or whatever you would call it. But to be able to manipulate it like that, to be able to put someone into a state like that or help them, assist them getting into a state like that, that's a very very unique skill.
Yeah, I mean, all hypnosis is self-hypnosis anyway. So you do it. I just guide you into it, you know, and, you know, give you ways of just going into hypnosis is a natural state. Like we said, I was talking earlier, like, you know, you're driving and all of a sudden you end up there and you think, shit, how did I get there? I don't do that because I'm rubbish at driving. But, you know, other things where it just seems to, television's hypnosis, music's hypnosis, they're all different states and we're all in different states all the time.
So like a movie that just captures you and you don't even realize you're watching it. You're just totally captivated. You're inside. Yeah. You're completely absorbed in the film. That's almost like a hypnotic state.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, clapping for Superman, for instance. We know Superman doesn't exist, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Sorry to break anyone's hearts out there that love Superman. But, you know, it's just a part and parcel of using your imagination to get you to a place where you want to change.
So, but that state that you achieve when you hypnotize someone, when you put someone in this really relaxed place and you have them focus on very specific things and you get them to this weird state where your mind drifts off into that dreamland, that's very different than a movie or very different than driving home in your car. It's pretty intense.
Yeah, it is. They're all imaginative processes anyway, you know? They're all imaginative processes. But with hypnosis, you're focusing on a specific problem. Normally, you know, you focus on a specific problem. So it's the lead into it. It depends how the client is. I don't always use hypnosis. I am a mind coach. I don't class myself as a hypnotist, although hypnotherapy is part and parcel of what I do. I class myself as a mind coach because there's different facets to it. There's different ways of leading people into various things and considerations about what they say, especially using language. When it's out of sync sort of thing, doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then you might, you know, have to make sense of it. And then unconsciously, your unconscious mind deciphers it and gets you the best results, really.
Well, it's fascinating to me because for the longest time, mind coaches were sort of unheard of in combat sports. It was almost like it was a scarlet letter or a mark against you because you were so weak that you needed someone to figure out how to hypnotize you or how to talk you into being strong. You needed a you should just be a fucking man and get out there and do it. Right? Like, that was the attitude that a lot of people had.
Yeah, in England they say, don't be so fucking soft. Go on, you'll be all right. Don't be so fucking soft.
They say that
soft.
In America, too.
Yeah.
But they don't say it with that same
I would say it with the same Cockney same tone. Accent. I don't know why I did a Cockney tone there from the North. Yeah, I mean, it was... it's all macho. You know, don't, you know, get on with it, blah, blah, blah. I've seen more people who are very, very skilled get beat by their own self.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen that, you know, their own minds, and then it can be a very... It can be very hard for people.
Well, the reason why I was going to bring that up, because I think that fighting in particular is probably the most difficult of all chosen endeavors. Outside of being a soldier, it's the most difficult of all chosen endeavors as far as chosen goals that you're trying to accomplish. What you're trying to accomplish is you're trying to use your body, use your bones and your muscle to defeat other people who are also using their bones and muscle, and the techniques are all readily available. There's no secrets anymore. I mean, there's a few secrets. If you have really good coaches, you can get some tips, but essentially everybody knows how to punch, everybody knows how to kick, and you're just trying to figure out how to maximize your possibilities, maximize your potential for victory, and how to not get in your own way, how to not trip over your own fears and anxiety. And that's where this mind coach thing comes into play. And that's where I think it's applicable not just for fighting, but also for just life in general. Because I think that for a lot of people, their success or failure, a big part of it is predicated on how they view life and how they view themselves and how they approach each thing, each obstacle, each goal, each endeavor that they're attempting to solve or to give their own expression to. And I think that if it works on fighting, it'll probably work on anything. And if you can get someone to a better place mentally where they can become a more effective fighter and stay out of their own way in terms of their anxiety and their fears, like, the reality of fighting is you're probably going to get hurt at some point in time. It's just part of what you're doing. You're in the hurt business. This is the hurt game. And somewhere along the line, you're going to get hit, and you're hopefully going to hit the other person more than they're going to hit you. But bad things happen to great fighters.
Yeah.
We've all seen it.
Yeah, I mean, it's part and parcel of everything. You know, if I can make... It's not just about fighters. I mean, I do work with fighters because I come from a Muay Thai background. I've been involved in it a long time, 30 years now. And fighting's hard, as you know, of course, but fighting yourself as well as an opponent, as well as trying to listen to your corner, as well as hearing people scream your name or other people screaming for them, other person to kick your ass, it's difficult. You have to kind of go within, mm-hmm. you know, and control everything that you do and try and impose what you've got to do on the other person.
Yeah, doubts and fear, they're extra weights that you carry into the ring.
Yeah.
Or into the cage. And in life, I mean, and again, it's analogous to life. Doubts and fears, on top of the reality of the difficulty of whatever you're trying to do, whatever you're trying to do, those doubts and fears, they're like, it's like a heavy weight vest that you're carrying on top of the burden of whatever you're trying to accomplish in the first place. And for fighters, it can be just smothering. We've had many instances of guys backstage that either didn't fight or almost didn't fight because they were having anxiety attacks, because they were freaking out, because the moment was finally there. Yeah. And their mind was just running away from them.
Yeah.
Their mind was trying to figure out a way out of this. Like, we can figure out a way out of this. All we have to do is just go crazy here, and the doctor will come over, and you know, how about you have a few heart palpitations and fall down, you can't breathe, and then the doctor's going to rescue you.
Yeah, or you're ill.
No more fighting.
Yeah, you're ill. I hope the doctor finds something wrong with me because I'm ill.
Yeah.
Everyone's considered that. I mean, I did the same. I thought, you know, if he sees that I'm ill, I've got a cough, I'm ill, and then I don't have to go in there. But, you know, it's about controlling that. Fights are won and lost in the changing rooms.
Sometimes.
A lot of the time, you know.
But you could be the most confident. You can be the most confident motherfucker on earth. But if you're fighting Anderson Silva in his prime and you're not that good, you're probably still going to get lit up.
Yep.
And that's a problem. I mean, you could,
getting yourself lit up as bad as you could, as you would if you didn't do anything about it.
Mm.
You know?
Maybe. You know, there's only so much.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, there is. I mean, not everyone's going to be a champion.
Right.
That's fact.
That is a fact.
You know, it's you know, they don't throw these belts around, do they? The UFC and the WBC boxing, they don't just give you a belt. You know, and there's always... But from my point of view, I like seeing people conquer shit. That really debilitate them. Whether they win, lose or draw, sometimes it's irrespective. It's the experience or of them saying, I did a lot better than I thought I would do, and... You know, and all that sort of stuff. And they can live with it. Some people lose, and they just never forget it. And it can haunt them for, eternity, really.
Yeah, they define themselves. That's a real issue with human beings. They define themselves by their past failures. Even though they've learned from those mistakes, they always look at themselves as like, God, I'm the guy who did this. Mm. I'm the guy who shit his pants. I'm the guy who, you know, got in that car accident. I'm the guy who... showed up late and got fired from my job. And you become, instead of a human being who has a lifelong, just a giant string of experiences, a lot of them that you've learned from and that you're better because of, instead you have the sting, like the emotional sting of those failures that just haunt people. And that's very common with people. They get haunted. That's why some people are haunted by high school. By grammar school and high school bullies.
Yeah, definitely.
Being bullied, like, defined them during their formative state. And, you know, I've known a lot of fighters who, if they've carried chips on their shoulders deep into their 40s from being bullied when they were in high school.
A funny story, when I lived in a place in England called Macclesfield, and it's on a big hill where I used to live, and I seen the guy who used to live next door to me, his mum used to live next door to me, he used to live there as well, and he was 60. Something like that. And I seen him at the top of the road. And he was stood at the top of the road and he was looking down the bottom of the road like this. He was looking again. And he was just stood there. And I said, what are you doing? And he went, there's two guys down there. They used to bully me at school. I'm waiting for them to go. 60. 60 years of age still.
He said, I'm waiting for them to
leave. Yeah, he was waiting for them to go. Billy's name is. And he was just stood there and waiting for them to go. That, I like to change. And I would love to change. It's sad. Think about it. It's a long time, you know, for him to... You know, and it's a small town, Macclesfield, where he used to live, so he's probably bumped into them, he's probably avoided them in the store, the shops or whatever.
So for 43 years, this guy's been haunted.
Maybe more,
because before then, in school.
And I hate that. I just, it's, you know, it's sad. It's a real sad situation.
It is sad, but it also seems to be bizarrely and cruelly a part of human nature, a part of animal nature.
Yeah.
So if the animals fuck with other animals,
they
try to find the pecking order.
Yeah,
and it motivates the weak ones to be strong. It motivates people to stand up for themselves. And that's where, I mean, the bullying is a horrible thing, but bullying is also the reason why a lot of great fighters exist. Guys like George St. Pierre, I mean, he's pretty open about it. Like, the reason why he became a great fighter, because he was tired of people fucking with him. Mm. And he might not have ever become the guy who he became if it wasn't for that pressure.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for those obstacles that were thrown in front of his face, you know, and that's... It's unfortunate that it happens, but objectively, if you step back and look at just life itself, it seems to be an inexorable part of our existence on this planet. There's a pull and a push, and if there's no one pushing, there's no pulling, and if there's no, you know what I'm saying? If there's no,
negative,
oftentimes the positive doesn't reach the same heights.
No, it doesn't. In a lot of cases. But it's, if you can chip away at it, or at least change some perspective on it for a person. This is why someone said to me once when they wanted to be a mind coach that, well, I'm only going to work with athletes. I'm not going to do therapy. It's all therapy. It's all therapy, regardless of fighters. It's not always about them being nervous about fighting. The fight doesn't scare her. It might be something to do with the girlfriend, a loss of a family member, whatever. Or, you know, it goes back, way back. It's all part of people's journeys. It's all part of people being who they are.
Therapy has a negative connotation in a lot of people's minds because they connect it to self-indulgence.
Yeah.
Like, are you going to go to therapy every day and just whine and bitch about your life? And and we've all met people that are doing that.
I have.
You know? We've all met people that are just locked. So for them, it's sort of more about having the opportunity to use someone to talk about themselves. It's an ego trip in a lot of ways. Instead of trying to solve whatever whatever influences that they have control over them.
As a therapist, you get to know. As a mind coach, you get to know who will do carry on doing that behaviour. It's secondary gain. Some people do the behaviour just for a gain, just to, you know, get themselves where they want to get to get where they want to get. You kind of decipher from that. I don't play that game. I just give them, you know, well, really? You know, and I'm kind of, they can be kind of tough with it. But, you know, if you want them to change, if they don't want to change, nothing you can do.
Right.
You know, I don't want to, I don't have these dragged out long, you know, therapy sessions of and then this and this and this happened and that happened. I try and get right to it, right to the core of it. And that's because of the way I was trained. I was trained by a guy called Colin Mackay, who's absolutely like Yoda, you know, my teacher. And I was trained that way, and it has good success.
And you, how did you get involved with him?
I got involved with Colin. I went to a seminar many years ago by a guy called Keith Mayer. And I was at a bad time of my life, being a bit of an idiot, drinking, snorting dancing powder, etc. I wasn't being the best I could be. And I went to a seminar, Keith Mayer, loved it, felt great, didn't know why. Just really started reading books, everything, Dr. Wayne Dyer and all sorts of things like that. Mm-hmm. And then I got hold of, wanted to do a course with a company, and the company was good. But I found out about Colin, and that was it. Since then, he's become a friend, and he's just smart, super smart.
Well, it's interesting because your main pursuit with this, or your main focus with this, is fighters. So you're dealing with a very concentrated version of this kind of problem solving.
Yeah.
Because of the fact that the existence is so intense. Mm-hmm. It's so difficult psychologically, it's so difficult emotionally, and it's very difficult physically as well. There's so many factors involved in being a successful fighter. Mm-hmm. And you are involved in probably like the most concentrated form of dealing with anxiety and problem solving and the ability to see results.
Yeah. To be honest, I never thought of it like that. I didn't, because I've been around it so long. Mm-hmm. I never really thought of it like that. I just do what I do.
Well, if you think about it, like a person, like say if a guy was a banker or, you know, an insurance salesman or something like that, and they had a bunch of issues that are keeping them back from being successful at their chosen endeavor, their failure, pro or con, is only financial. You know,
but it's relative to them, isn't it?
It is
relative to them.
But the intensity of it.
Yeah.
Like the intensity of a guy going into battle like yourself, about to go and trying to find coughs and reasons why someone's going to step in and rescue you from what is ultimately your entire focus for the last 6 to 8 weeks. You've been ready for this one moment, and the moment's here, and you're ready to get the fuck out of there. Right?
Yeah,
there's nothing
true
like that in the world of being a banker.
I suppose there's not, but because I've been around it so long. Mm-hmm. You know, 30 years been around it, Muay Thai. And I've seen so many really good fighters in the gym. Like, awesome.
Right.
Kicking pads, sharp, clinched, everything was sweet. Sparring was on point. And then just to see this different, I think of it like this, like a really, like making a really nice wedding cake. And then when you're going to show it to the people that are going to the wedding, just fucking squash it. That's always felt like to me. It's just like, just destroyed their own creation, all the stuff that they've done in the gym.
Well, maybe a better analogy is you wheel that wedding cake out and it melts instantly under the hot lights of the stage.
Yeah.
Which is really what it is.
Yeah, it does.
When you have it in a regular room, the lights aren't that hot.
Yeah.
And you, when you have someone in the gym, I mean, there's a lot of pressure sparring in the gym, of course. You know, there's a lot of, there's great fighters. You're working out with people who are very dangerous. There's a lot of expectations and anxiety, but it's nothing compared to an actual fight itself. No, that's when everything's ramped up.
Yeah. I mean, especially like you said, there's people who have been bullied as well. Mm-hmm. And you have to consider who you are. You have to consider everything about yourself, you know, going on that stage, going into that lion's den, so to speak, and, you know, the gladiatorial sort of archetype of it all. But it is difficult, but there is techniques that work really, really well.
Techniques that work really well to get the person out of these negative states of mind, these negative patterns.
To get them, because what can happen is you can go away with a train of thought. So it magnifies and goes on and on, gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and the self-talk gets really intense, so it trips you up completely and then can overthrow you and make you a minimum of what you can actually achieve, you know what I mean?
And you've recently started working with my friend Ian McCall
I have,
who's another great UFC fighter. He's very excited about the results, very happy about the results.
All right, good. I'm glad about that.
He loves it. Yeah, we were talking about it, and he was like, I'm 100% sold. I really, you know, when I first, he said when he first started doing it, he was like, we'll see.
Yeah.
But then, you know, once he really experienced it, he was like, okay, I'm going to be doing this from now on.
Yeah, I really like Ian McCall. He's a real nice guy. We've not done that much, really.
Did you work with him after his last fight? Did you work with him after the...
I've only been... I actually don't know because, you know, no disrespect, I haven't followed UFC that
How
much.
How dare you?
I know, I'm sorry. I'll leave now.
No, it's okay.
But I'll finish my coffee first. But polite, I'm English. But it's like, you know, I think it was after his last loss. He said he was feeling
John
certain
Lineker.
Things. Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that the guy, the little stocky guy that just wing shots him? Mm-hmm. I did see that. And since working with him, it's just... It's just about finding out who they are. Everyone's different, and that's why I like to work with people one-to-one. I do seminars. I'm over here doing seminars at the moment. But I like to work with people to find out what makes them tick, to find out what stimulates them and what doesn't, you know?
And what holds them up?
Yeah, definitely. But Ian McCall's a lovely guy. I really really like him.
Yeah, I like him as well.
And Joe...
Same thing.
Yeah, same.
Great,
same deal.
Great people.
Same deal. Yeah.
Yeah, and you work with Ross Pearson as well, who's another great guy.
I worked with Ross Pearson. I did some stand up. I used to teach Muay Thai. I was at a gym called Salford Muay Thai, and just holding pads and that. So I kind of fell out of love with it, really teaching, etc. Because mind coaching took over it. But yeah, I worked with Ross as well. He's another super guy.
So you're not doing Muay Thai training anymore. You're basically doing all mind coach stuff now.
Yes, sir. And commentary for Yokao and. Fusion.
Yeah, and for folks who don't know, Vinny used to do commentary for It's Showtime, which is one of the bigger kickboxing events in the world before it was bought out by Glory. Yeah. And now it's Glory is struggling a bit in the United States, unfortunately. I don't know why. It's just, to me, I'm such a huge fan of it. I think, you know, you watch a fight like Simon Marcus versus... Artun Levin, it's a fucking great fight. I was watching it this morning again in the gym. It was amazing, amazing fight.
Yeah.
Five rounds, went to a draw.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a fucking war between two of the very best guys in the world. So exciting, high-level stuff.
I've never seen anyone train. I was at Muay Thai in America last year with my friend Brian Dobler from Fontana. He was training there. Simon was training at his gym. I've never seen anyone train like him. He is a machine.
Really?
You know?
Well, he looks like a machine.
Ridiculous. Yeah, he does.
And his fight with Joe Schilling, holy shit, what a fight that was.
Yeah.
What a fight.
Yeah.
And Joe wound up knocking him out in the fourth round. They went three rounds. It was a draw after three rounds, and Joe knocked him out in the fourth. It was a fucking crazy
but
fight.
Joe Schilling gets up. This Joe Schilling's like the guy out of Halloween, Michael Myers. You know, you knock him down, he's getting back up.
Yeah.
And he's special.
And you were working with him before that fight.
Yeah, I was. I worked with him before the first Glory when he won it.
When he beat Artun Levin.
Yeah. I asked him. I met Joe. I'll be honest with you, Joe. I had a bit of a chip on his shoulder. He was a bit angry and stuff. You know what I mean? He won't mind me telling you this because he said I can. So don't beat me up. And he was a bit like that. And I seen him at K1 because I did K1 in Los Angeles a while ago. I was talking to him. I said, you're miles better than what you come across on the internet. You're a much better person than what you act. And I kind of stuck home with him. He made me a friend on Facebook. And then I contacted him and said, you know, do you want me to work with you? And he went, yeah, sure, cool. And then we got on. He's so smart. He picks things up so quickly. He's so open to stuff. We've done some really, really cool stuff that's... I can experiment on Joe, if that makes sense. You know, some things that I want to try, and I do them, and he seems to work really well on him. So.
Like, can you give us an example? Like, what do you mean, like, things that you want to experiment with?
Right, it's really strange, but it's like, I had a thing about, because I'm English, at Sir Galahad, the Knight of Sir Galahad, you know, the Knights of the Round Table.
Yes.
You know, King Arthur. And Joe didn't want to get injured because he was going to fight, I think he was Robert something or other he was fought on Glory, and then he was going to fight on Bellator against Melvin Manhoef.
Okay.
And he wanted to come out unscathed. So we persuaded his unconscious mind to have armour like Sir Galahad. So I talked in hypnosis about the archetype of knights, of the Knights of the Round Table, and he was Sir Galahad. Not literally, obviously, but, you know, so he had armour so he didn't come out mm-hmm. uninjured.
Right.
You know, and it worked. I'm not saying it's going to work for everything, you know, like, oh, good, you know, start your bullets and stuff like that, you know what I mean? But it was that getting his mindset into that sort of the way of thinking.
So,
you know?
Do you think
he was so worried about getting injured?
Right. So, is that why it was effective? Because it mitigated the stress that he had of worried about getting injured?
Sidelining
stuff.
Because
that can fuck you, right?
Of course.
If you go, like, God, I don't get hurt. God, I don't get hurt. That getting hurt is in the back of your mind, replaying over and over and over again.
Yeah, indeed. There was one instance, Liam Harrison was fighting a Thai called Anawat Kial Samlit, and he'd fought him before and got stopped in Jamaica when John Wayne Parr fought against Borkal Porpramuk. And Liam had been stopped in, I think it was a fourth round, with low kicks. So we did a hypnosis to make him... called hypnosis, and the trigger word was warrior. You know, he kept this word because Liam's, have you ever seen Liam Harrison fight? He's an incredible fighter. And along with Jordan Watson and Andy House and all them from Bad Company in England. And what we did was, we did this hypnosis, and when I was commentating on the show, because he was fighting Anawat, in round four, and this just freaked me out really, to be honest, he looked at me and he looked me straight in the eye and he went, warrior. And then beat shit out of Anawat, won on points. And yet afterwards I said, do you remember saying warrior? And he went, no, didn't remember it. So it was that stuck in his head. That was that.
Well, in all fairness, he probably got hit in the head a bunch of times during that fight, too.
Doing, yes.
Do you remember where you live? No.
Yeah.
What's
do you
your
know
phone
who
number?
You are?
I have no fucking idea. Did I win?
Yeah. Who am I?
I mean, how many times has a fighter won a fight and then asked what happened?
Yeah.
That does happen.
Because but I feel that is a state as well.
It's both, right?
Yeah. Are we talking about?
Flow state, that hypnotic state.
It's satori, isn't it, in the Japanese martial arts? I think it's a state. Did Muhammad Ali talk about it when Muhammad Ali fought Cleveland Williams?
Mm-hmm.
He was in that kind of state. You know,
that's my favorite Ali fight. I'm so glad you brought that up.
He was just, wasn't he breathtaking?
I've played that fight on this podcast at least three times.
Yeah, he was in a state. He was in this flow.
And that's before he went away for 3 years, before they took away his ability to fight.
Yeah.
Because he wouldn't fight in the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And then he came back and he was never the same again. That Cleveland Williams fight to me is like quintessential
breathtaking.
Ali.
People should watch that.
That just showed his full potential. But yeah, he was in that sort of flow state.
Yeah. Pernell Whitaker the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's one fight where he fought Harold Brazier.
Yes.
And when he moved up to light welterweight, do you remember?
Mm-hmm.
And he slipped. I'm trying to do it. I can't do it, by the way. But he slipped, and then just stepped around him and patted him on the arse. And like, come on now. That's ridiculous skill.
Yeah. Well, Whitaker is one of those guys that people kind of forget about.
Yeah.
You know, like, everyone wants to talk about Julio Cesar Chavez and some great fighters from that era.
He beat Chavez. He beat Chavez that fight.
I think he won. I think he won as well.
Of course he did.
But he was one of those guys that, for whatever reason, people have kind of forgotten about him. Meldrick Taylor, a lot of people have forgotten about Meldrick Taylor.
Meldrick Taylor. Well, Meldrick Taylor, I shouldn't say this. When Meldrick Taylor lost to Cristiano Espana in, I think he fought in Ireland or somewhere. Oh, no. It was on the Razor Ruddock and Lennox Lewis bill. I cried. I loved Meldrick Taylor. He was like my everything. He was my, shouldn't say that, should I?
Whoa. That's like
sorry,
a song.
It's come out the closet, no. No, but he was just, I loved watching him. His fight with Chavez was just an all-time classic.
Yeah, well, Chavez changed him. He was never the same after that fight.
No.
After he got stopped in the 12th, you know, I mean, with like seconds to go.
Two
and
parts
Richard
of his
Steele,
own blood or something,
oh,
wasn't
yeah.
it?
He was swallowing his own blood from the mouth cuts. But it was just, it was heartbreaking because after that he was just literally never the same. And I remember
Terry Norris destroyed him, didn't he, in four rounds.
And Terry Norris is bouncing on his feet, and then Terry. I mean, you see Terry now; he's fucked out too.
Yeah, has he got Parkinson's?
They're both fucked.
Is his trainer training? He's training Golovkin, isn't he?
Who? His trainer?
Abel Sanchez is now training Golovkin.
Yes, he is. He's training him up in Big Bear.
Who I love.
Love Golovkin.
If you watch Golovkin explain how he fights, he always talks about how he feels. He talks about emotion. He talks about how he feels. And everything you see him, even when he's hitting the back, you see him feeling the shot. You know? Instead of going, he can see him, every single part of him, considering everything that he does. And apparently he even beats people up. I think I heard that Kovalev had left that gym because of Gennady Golovkin, rumour has it.
Really?
And he drops him with a body shot. Yeah, he's a monster.
Kovalev, who fights 15 pounds heavier too.
Yeah. That's the rumour. I'm not saying
I love rumours. Spread it up.
Spread it. I don't live in England anymore. In Liverpool, I've moved. You know what I mean? Or Kovalev knocking on my doors. It was Joe Rogan's fault. He made me say it.
Kovalev is a monster,
too.
He's
incredible. And look what he did to Bernard Hopkins.
That was pretty shocking. Pretty shocking. You know, see Bernard Hopkins in fully defensive survival mode.
Yeah. Especially in round 12. I thought it looked like he let him off a bit in round 12, I thought.
But did you think so? I didn't think so.
I thought he was chasing him down. I don't know. He's very brutal. He's on my friend's Facebook.
Ooh.
And
very exciting.
Yeah, we're dropping names. But it's before he was famous. But he seems to like violent stuff, you know.
He's a scary guy.
He's a very, very scary guy.
Well, he killed a guy in the ring. A guy died in one of his fights.
It
didn't seem to affect him at all. You know, a lot of times, like with Ray Mancini or Emil Griffith, there's a lot of fighters, they'll kill somebody.
Yeah, Barry McGuigan did as well, didn't he?
Did he?
Yeah, Barry McGuigan killed somebody as well.
I didn't remember that.
Yeah.
But something happens to them after that where they're never quite the same.
Yeah, Nigel Benn.
Yes.
Nigel Benn was the same. I met Nigel. It's interesting, again.
Joe McClellan fight.
Yeah, if you listen to that at the end of it. He said, Nigel Benn says, the first person I'd like to thank is Paul McKenna for hypnotising me and making me believe in myself. And I met Nigel Benn about 2 months ago, and I love...
He said that after McClellan fight?
Yes, you watch it.
Wow.
The first thing he said, I'd like to thank Paul McKenna for hypnotising me and making me believe in myself. Because he apparently had a separation of his wife and his girlfriend. That fucks people up, you know, emotionally.
Yeah.
So there's a grief attached to it, isn't there, you know? And Nigel, and I mentioned that to Nigel Benn, a massive fan. And I mentioned that. I said, I got into mind coaching because how, you know, what he got out of the ring, he got knocked out of the ring, did he? First round, and McClellan was just a monster. Now,
McClellan was in his prime and a destroyer back then.
Yeah.
And everyone was talking about McClellan eventually fighting Roy Jones Jr. I mean, that was the big super fight that was on the horizon. Sort of like, you know, people are anticipating all the different fights right now for Golovkin. They're anticipating possibly Cotto.
Yeah.
If not Cotto, maybe one day
Canelo
Alvarez. Yeah, that's a possibility.
Yep.
Like, that's how they were looking at him until the Nigel Benn fight. And it looked like he was just going to kill Nigel Benn, just beating the fuck out of him. But two things. One, the weight cut issue. That was a big issue because Gerald McLevin was huge and he was cutting a lot of weight to get down to that weight class. And that was back when, you know, people weren't doing it well. They weren't rehydrating with IVs. And particularly in boxing, the weight cutting mentality in wrestling is a totally different mentality because you could wrestle dehydrated. And although your performance will probably suffer, you are not as concerned about head trauma. And the head trauma that these guys get when they're dehydrated is very, very dangerous because the bleeding on the brain is just way more devastating. Apparently all the deaths that have ever occurred, or almost all the deaths that ever occurred in boxing, have occurred outside of the heavyweight division. And the reason being that those are the guys that are cutting the weight and the heavyweights aren't. But there's this one guy that got really fucked up on HBO, I want to say a year or two ago. He fought that Cuban kid. Was it Eric Perez that he fought? Is that the guy's name he fought? I don't remember. I'm not doing a good job of remembering it. But it was a rare instance of a heavyweight being like really badly concussed in a fight and having bleeding on the brain and having to get an operation. He was a Russian guy. Anyway, point being,
but it's
that McClellan fight was pretty crazy.
When they did the documentary on Gerald McClellan, because that was, you know, a fan of Gerald McClellan, who's like, you know, knocked out Julian Jackson. Julian Jackson, I think it was like seven rounds, maybe knocked him out in like one or whatever. But he said on the second fight in the interview afterwards, when I fought you the first time, I had a headache for 3 weeks. I had a headache for 3 weeks after fighting you. That isn't a good sign.
Yeah.
You know, that isn't a good sign. And all of the documentaries have missed that out because I watched it and I thought, I remember because I just, you know, something sticks in your head. And I just thought, he's not mentioned that. They never mentioned how he was, and apparently they sparred really hard and all that. But,
he's from Kronk.
Yeah. They don't play.
No.
They don't
Kronk Gym. Not only do they not play, they used to crank the temperature up.
Yeah.
That's true. Emmanuel Stewart would crank it up like 100 degrees in that place. It was like a sauna.
Yeah, they couldn't have no rap music and any swearing as well. And he believed in, like, when Lennox Lewis fought Oliver McCall, he made Oliver McCall wear white boxing boots because he thought that he made him move quicker.
Hmm.
Strange.
Yeah, well,
strange.
But if it
adds to stuff.
Yeah. Emmanuel Stewart is an interesting guy because he's so nice. He's so personable.
Was nice.
Dead now.
Sadly.
Yeah, but he was such a nice guy. And when a trainer is such a nice guy like that, oftentimes, like, it seems like the fighters want to fight harder for them.
Yeah.
Like, they want to win more. Like, they have this more of, like, there's nothing worse than a fighter that has a contentious relationship with their trainer.
Yeah.
And then there's some sort of animosity between the two of them. They leave, they come back. And you see a lot of that. And it really trips a lot of fighters up, that those contentious relationships they have with their trainers.
Because I think a lot of the times, though, with fighters, sometimes it may take the position of a father figure, you know, or an elder brother, or, you know, especially a father figure, because a lot of, like, have come from, you know, not the best start in life, you know what I mean? So
a lot of them come from a place with no father.
Yeah, indeed.
Big percentage.
Yeah, indeed. You know, so, you know, I always, you know, my trainers, I looked up to them and wanted to please them as well.
Right.
It's just, I just think it's part and parcel of it, really.
It is, and I think that's why a guy like Emmanuel Stewart was so successful, not just because of his deep knowledge of boxing and his understanding of technique, which all were certainly there, but also just because he was such a great guy.
Yeah. It was when Thomas Hearns fought Sugar Ray Leonard. I remember reading that Emmanuel Stewart and Tommy Hearns locked themselves away for 2 weeks and just cried.
Wow.
That's passion.
Jesus,
you know?
Christ.
That's passion.
Get out of the house.
Yeah, I know. Ring me.
Yeah.
Rewind time and ring me. And I was only 11 then.
Were there any, back then, did anybody use a mental coach back then? Do you know of anything? When did it start in combat sports?
I don't know. I'm the only one in the world, and that's it.
That's not true.
No, I don't know. I've never heard of anyone that does it. I know these scenes have seen sports psychologists and stuff. I know that Steve Collins, before he fought Chris Eubank, sorry, going about boxing.
I love boxing. Keep going.
When Steve Collins fought Chris Eubank, he came in with earphones in and knelt in the ring, and it played with Eubank's head because Nigel Benn used a hypnotherapist, Paul McKenna, to go through all that to beat Gerald McClellan.
Mm-hmm.
And then Eubank, because he'd injured Michael Watson so badly, that he had this in his head that if Steve Collins is like this, he won't know when he's hurt because he'll get in such a state, he won't know when he's beat. You know
so
what I mean?
So he was worried that Collins was going to take too much punishment.
Yeah, or whatever whatever the game was, but it worked for Collins because Collins beat Chris Eubank twice.
We might have beat him anyway.
Might have beat him anyway, but it's shenanigans, isn't it?
It's
mind games.
Yeah, it's like the fragile psyche of a person that's about to go into unarmed combat like that. It's really interesting because most people would think of them as fearless. They're just the toughest motherfuckers on the planet about to step in between those ropes and duke it out. But meanwhile, they're balancing back and forth, and there's doubt and fear and all these different things that are playing on their mind. You've seen the Mike Tyson movie, right?
Yes.
The documentary?
Yes.
That one thing that he did, that speech where he described what it was like to walk into the ring and what he felt like and how he had all these doubts until he got into the ring. And then when he got into the ring, he was a god.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, he used hypnotherapy, didn't he?
Did he?
Customato used hypnotherapy. I heard it on your show because I didn't know. And I heard it, one of your guys said, I don't know who he was speaking to, I apologize.
I wish I could remember everything.
I know, I wish I could remember. I could remember where my feet were sometimes. But, he was talking, he said that Customato used it.
Well, Customato was certainly one of the first and most prominent to talk about psychology to a fighter. And it was a main point of focus in like interviews about Tyson, where he would talk about the things that D'Amato told him. And D'Amato, in the footage that they have of him, you know, there's many, many different speeches that he gave to Tyson that were on recordings.
Yeah.
And, you know, the one about fire being, yeah. you know,
fear being your friend. Yeah.
yeah. It fears like fire.
I'll tell you what I really like. I like Freddie Roach, of course.
Freddie's
great.
We're
going to see him soon. I really like having my pictures up with him. I was over the moon. It's like a little kid on the scene. I was like, what's Freddie Roach?
He's a very nice guy.
He is
too.
Very nice. Very, very, very accommodating. Well, Virgil Hunter, if you listen to what Virgil Hunter says, he's got metaphors, which are learning stories. He says a lot of cool things that are like about life and about. I think if you've got experience of life and you can convey it in such a way that it helps, mm-hmm. and that's more power to you, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and Anne Wolfe too. You know, from the female side, the way she trained Kirkland.
Yeah,
you know, like there's probably very few trainers as ferocious in the world as that woman.
Yeah.
Some of the training that she used to have that guy do.
Is she the one that knocked that, the big tall girl with boom timber?
Yes.
Yeah,
ridiculous.
Right shot, that, wasn't it?
One punch knockout. She could fucking bang.
Yeah, she could.
Woo! So that was a chick that Christy Martin avoided like she was on fire.
Right.
Like, get away from me. She didn't want to have nothing to do with Anne Wolfe. And there's a great video of Anne Wolfe driving a truck.
Yeah,
and she's got a harness on the front of it with a heavy bag hanging from
it. Seen it.
And Kirkland's backing up, doing his heavy bag work, backing up. It's fucking fantastic.
But then when he fought Canelo,
didn't have her in a corner.
Oh, but like that shot Canelo hit him with that. Oh,
well, he didn't train with her. And he didn't have her in his corner, and you know she was actually still managing him too. It was just the whole thing was a mess. That's unfortunate, but you know what? Canelo might have done that to him anyway.
Yeah, I mean,
Canelo's a motherfucker.
I'm telling you, he's dangerous, isn't he? There is all that, but it's like, you know, I think it's Prince Nazim Hamed was amazing back in his day when he left Brendan Ingle. They had a really close relationship from seven, and you know, old Irish guy, and he has got loads of stories and you know metaphors and blah blah blah. And since when he left Winkerbank, which is in Sheffield, not far from me, really, he wasn't the same.
Right.
He wasn't the same. It's like Tyson and Kevin Rooney.
Right.
They just seem to have a gel. They seem to know and have a system that works. Well, look at Tyson was incredible. I thought with Kevin Rooney.
Well, Kevin Rooney was still a part of the Custamato legacy.
Yeah.
You know, he had trained under D'Amato as well, and they kind of carried over. But he didn't have the same relationship with Kevin Rooney that he had with Custamato, where it was he wanted Custamato's happiness.
Yeah.
He wanted Custamato's love. He wanted Custamato to really appreciate.
Father figure again, isn't it?
Exactly.
It's the father figure again.
I mean, D'Amato really literally was. Yeah. I mean, he took him in.
Yeah.
But again, it comes back to what you do and what your focus is, where it is really about mental states.
Yeah.
That mental state of wanting to please the father, wanting to please this mentor, wanting to this person that you love and care so much about their opinion and their idea of you, that it becomes a significant motivating factor.
Yeah, it does.
And that tapping into these factors, tapping into whatever it is that allows you to achieve that amazing state of success.
Well, that's why I like to get my clients. I like to get to know my clients. In every way, because then you get the best from them. Then there's a saying that's less than 100% support is sabotage. So if you're not getting 100% with them, and they're not giving you 100% back, you're never going to get what you can really achieve. But it's like I like to really get to know them, to understand them. Once you're a client, you're always going to be a client forever. You know, I've got a support system where. Again, as I was saying, learnt that off Colin, is like, you know, they get back to you on a regular basis, and I never keep out of touch with them because I always want them to, you know, if they need me, you know. Because I'm not needy. No, I don't need to be needed. But I like staying in contact with them.
Right.
Well, I like success. I love it.
Well, you also develop, it's a project.
Yeah.
I mean, you develop a relationship with this person, and that person becomes a project.
Yeah.
And so you seem to get a great thrill out of other people becoming successful, which is a great quality.
Uh-huh.
And
Thank you.
The exact quality that you need in order to be a mentor,
yeah.
you know, in order to be a coach, in order to be the best coaches are clearly the coach that gets personal enjoyment and has a real deep investment in the student getting better.
Yeah. It's like I have a lot of praise off coaches. Mark, I think his name's Mark Kimura, who's Joe's coach. I was talking to Joe on FaceTime, and then Mark says, you've done a really good job. I really like that. I don't know. It may sound come across a bit, I don't know, gushy, but I just love it. I really love it. Mm-hmm. I just love the way, I love fighters. I like people achieving. I like people getting out of darkness. I know what it's like to be there. You know what I mean? And it's nothing more of a relief than not being there. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
You know, just point in the right direction, see people just glow, and they think, you know, and they get that eureka moment, the light bulb moment, where they've done something wicked, or they've done something they didn't think they could do. That, for me, is priceless. I didn't get paid for it, of course. It's a job, but it's priceless to me. Priceless.
Well, that's probably why you're drawn to it. Well, that's why you're good at it. And that's
Thank
what
you.
You kind of have to be that, right?
Yeah.
In order to be good at that job.
Yeah.
Like, the worst thing you could ever be as a mentor is to be jealous of the success of your student.
Yeah.
Or to hope that your student doesn't do as well. But we've all seen that. We've all seen that from coaches. We've
seen that.
I mean, everyone's seen sabotage from coaches. That's dark shit.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. There is an element of jealousy, envy, or whatever, mm-hmm. sabotage in people.
And it's oftentimes it's like former competitors.
Yeah.
You know?
You know, I think, I don't know if you agree with this, but I think when a coach has been a fighter, there's a transition from him being still a fighter to a coach.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I've got a friend called Frankie Udders who's got a really good gym in Wivenshaw in Manchester, and I see that with him. Now, he was a fighter, a very good one, and I can see the transition now of how he is of being a coach. He's like, got all these kids that look up to him, and, you know, like Jordan Watson's coach, Richard Smith. He is the same, and he got this sort of, you can see the transition because they were fighters and then they become mentors and coaches. I like watching that. That's interesting. Mm. It's an interesting metamorphosis. You know?
Yeah, it is. And it is an important metamorphosis, too, because if you always identify with being a fighter, you're never going to be a great coach.
Mm.
You have to accept this new stage of your life and embrace it the same way you embrace being a fighter.
Yeah.
To do it with 100% of your ability and your focus.
Yeah.
It's hard for some people because then it becomes not about them. It becomes about them helping other people. And some personalities are not really suited for that.
Well, fighters are about them. I mean, it's, you know, certain, not all of them, but certain amounts of it has to be about them because they're the ones that's taking the risk. They're the ones that are going to get in the beats, aren't they?
Right.
That go in the ring and take the shots and take the pain. You know what I mean? So it is difficult for a person to transition, but that's with the change of values. As you get older, your values change and you start to shift from value to value.
Do you have long-term goals as far as, like, what you're trying to do with mental coaching?
Yeah, I mean, I would like to get into coaching people to be mind coaches. But I want elite people. I don't want bullshitters. I don't want that. I want people as passionate as me. So,
right.
You know, we're going to be doing that in 2016. Colin's got a thing now, so if anyone wants to know about it, they can get me on my website, vinnyshoreman.com, or Facebook or whatever, the hypnosis page, and can tell them about, he's got a new sort of a series of videos where you can go step by step to learn to be a mind coach. My long-term goal is just to just keep improving, keep getting better myself, because I love it, reading all the time, but I'm quite boring, really, going on about it to people. My long-term goal is, well, look how well Mike Dolce's done with his diet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'd like to be that. I'd like to get that, to be the man to go to, the go-to guy. And have other people that have the same passion, you know, regardless of if it's fighting or not.
Mm-hmm.
Just people that just want to achieve or at least get something a little bit further, if not as really far.
How many people do you work with that are not fighters?
Quite a lot.
Yeah?
Yeah, quite a lot.
What's a common thing that they come to you with? They
confidence.
Want to improve. Confidence.
Everything is confidence. 99.9% of stuff is confidence. And just, yeah, confidence. And people come to me, it's always the same thing. They come in because I work from home or I work on Skype or FaceTime. And they always talk about what they don't want. That's the first thing out of everyone's mouth. They talk about what they don't want. And when you ask them what they do want, they still talk about what they don't want. So you have to change the direction of the thought pattern because they're just so focused on, say, it's that rock and the rock, and you have to just move them to where they want to go and then say, now what do you want? instead of focusing on that. Now, where do you want to go? Now, what are you doing? What, you know, that, okay, and we deal with that in various ways, timeline therapy, hypnosis, whatever, and then we move them towards where they want to go to.
So when you're dealing with someone and their issue is confidence,
yeah,
what are the factors? What are, like, the things that are holding people back? Are there common factors that you find over and over again with people that keep them from being confident?
No. This is the Sherlock syndrome, I call it. This is where you have to be like Sherlock. You have to, like, think,
Sherlock, yes, Holmes.
Sherlock Holmes in English. Right. And he has to think about it and find out what really is going on in there. That's why it's so cool.
Mm.
That's why it's so exciting, because everyone's different and they have this sort of, you know, this thing that keeps them back or whatever. It's strange. Everyone's different. It's whether it be a past relationship, whether it be, like you said, bullying, whether it be parents, whatever.
Or a current relationship.
Or a current relationship, yeah, that's toxic and they shouldn't be in it. I don't tell them not to be, because ecologically it's not right.
Ecologically? Psychologically?
Yeah, psychologically it's not right. And just,
like, it's
just
not good for the environment?
Yeah, it's not good for the environment. Oh,
it's bad for the
toxic
ocean.
Toxic, violent language, screaming and fighting with your missus. But, no, I just think that...
They have,
you know,
to figure that out for themselves.
They have to figure that out for themselves. And you kind of know anyway.
Right.
We've met people that you think, you shouldn't be with us.
Yeah.
She's fucking bananas. Or he's bananas or whatever.
Yeah, know? When I was young, I used to try to help those people. I used to try to, like, tell them, hey, man, you shouldn't be in that relationship.
You don't get no thanks.
You got to figure that shit out for yourself.
Yeah, you don't get no thanks
for
it.
No, everyone's going to be mad at you. Her, yeah. Him, everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it is about the environment around them.
Yes,
I just think,
it is ecological, yeah. Sort of, in some ways. Yeah, and it's also, many times, whatever's holding them back is also what led them to be in that relationship, that,
yeah,
toxic relationship, yeah, in the first place.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah.
Yeah, I've met people that their relationships is really essentially like a carryover of their mother. And that's always so odd. It's like I have friends who can't do anything unless they check in with their wife. They have to ask their wife before every purchase. They have to ask their wife before any decision, anything they want to do. They can't say, hey, I want to go to the game with Mike.
Yeah.
You know, you can't say that. You have to go and ask permission and see if it's okay and would it be all right. These are people that aren't even married.
But but because you travel and I travel because I, you know, commentate on Infusion and Yokow and stuff, if you had a girlfriend, mine soon's going to be my wife getting married in August, if you had that sort of where you're going, who you're with, blah, mm-hmm, blah, blah, it can't work.
I've had those before.
So have I.
They're brutal.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
On both sides.
Yeah.
You know, it's brutal for the man, it's brutal for the woman, it's brutal for the woman that's asking the man, where are you going, what are you doing?
Yeah,
it's a terrible mind state for, yeah, her to be in, too.
It's more about them than it is about it's more about them, what they're going through, their insecurities, their,
mm-hmm,
I have done that myself. You feel that, it's...
Well, it's very difficult, too, to grow inside of a relationship, because it seems like you have to have your own shit together before you can attract someone with their shit together.
Yeah.
So if you don't have your shit together, you usually wind up with someone who also doesn't have their shit together.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult, yeah, for the two of you together to work it out.
Yeah, like attracts like.
Yes. So, yeah, oftentimes people, like, they really do have to break up in order to get on, yeah, with their own life.
The trouble is to carry it to the next one. They say, oh, that was shit. That didn't work. Let's bring, yeah, it to the next one. And then it becomes a cyclic behavior.
Right.
You know, and then it's difficult.
That's the weirdest one, when you get involved with someone and then somewhere early in the relationship they start screaming at you. And you're like, whoa, 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 what the, yeah, fuck is going on here? Yeah. Like, what is this?
Yeah.
Is this what you do?
Well, it's boundaries, isn't it? It's,
yes,
where your boundaries are.
Sure.
You know, if you let someone overstep the boundary and overstep and they go further back, and then you end up not being you.
It is, and it's also patterns that people fall into because life is very confusing and because life is very stressful and there's a lot going on. So they fall into these patterns of making these same mistakes over and over again from one relationship to the next because there's comfort in those patterns.
Yeah.
And, you know, you recognize it early on because there aren't any real issues. Like, we've only known each other for a short amount of time. Mm. You're already fucking screaming at me for nothing?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
why,
yeah,
are you screaming at me?
Yeah.
You're screaming at me because of some other shit,
yeah,
that you've got that's trapped.
It's not been dealt with, and it's an unconscious,
yeah,
behavior. It's an unconscious reaction to a situation that's not been resolved.
And they think it's normal. It's normal to scream.
Yeah.
Because maybe they grew up with people screaming at each other or hitting each other or whatever. It's like this.
Yeah, it's all sort of, and then you tolerate it, and then increasingly it gets worse.
Yeah, and it's interesting how those sort of relationships can become, you can drown in them.
Yeah.
You know, both parties can drown because you just can't get out of them, and you're constantly involved in conflict, or the worst is conflict and resolution, and they get trapped in this high of making up, of fighting and then making up, fighting and making up.
And meanwhile, your life's going.
Yeah.
You're losing days.
Oh, yeah,
time,
you're fucked.
Time is something you're just not going to get back, ever. Yeah. You know, regardless how rich you are. I went to a seminar by a lady called Dolores Askoff Nowiski, who's she's part of the thing called the Servants of Light, which is an esoterical belief school.
Servants of Light?
Yeah.
I hate it already.
I know. It's an esoterical thing. It's nothing to do with me. I didn't name it that. Don't blame me.
Thank God you didn't.
But some of the things that she said, some of the things in the seminar she said are very relevant. You know, she was talking about tell us a story about time, saying that when she was in she lived in Jersey, which is just at the top of England, and that when in 1940 something or other the Germans were coming to invade, and she had to evacuate. So her dad said, well, look, you know, you're not gonna, I'm not gonna be able to buy anything for your birthday. We're gonna have to use all the money to be evacuated, because he's gonna go and live in Heswall, which is near me in Liverpool. And he said, well, what I'll do is I'll give you a book with paper, and I'll give you time. So every time you write a check, you write that you want to be with me in that time, and he honoured that time all the time. So it made me think about how important time is. We just don't get a lot of it.
Mm.
You know, I'm 45 now. I was 21 yesterday. You know, in my eyes, you know, my mum died in when was it? February? No, August last year. Boom. You know, your mum's there. All of a sudden, they're gone. It's very important what you do with your time. I think anyway.
It's everything.
Yeah, 100%.
It's also very difficult to stop and take account of what's going on in your life and try to figure out whether or not it's serving you to the best of its ability. If time is serving you, or if you are serving your own life, if your focus and what you're doing, your actions are serving your own existence to the best of your ability, or whether or not you're trapped in momentum.
Yeah.
Because that's often the case with people. Being trapped in momentum could rob you of your life, and you won't even realize it until it's too late.
It ruts, isn't it?
And then you're that 60-year-old guy on the hill looking down at the guys bullying
you. You're looking out the window with your blanket on your head going, bastard.
Mm-hmm.
Can I go again? No, you can't. There's no second throw of the dice, is there, you know?
No.
It's just the way it is.
But it's also really hard to figure out if you're trapped in an environment where the people around you haven't figured it out, and they're stuck in some patterns, maybe alcoholism and cigarettes and all the bullshit that's involved with whatever they've got going on in their life, crime or drama or whatever the fuck it is.
It's environment as well, isn't it? It's the environment that you're in.
Sure, and the patterns that you develop. That's really hard for people, to break out of the patterns that they grew up in.
Yeah, it is. It is, but it's part and parcel of the job that I do.
You can't say any more part and parcels. You said
did I
five
say that
times.
Loads of times?
Five.
I did a podcast the other week, and I kept saying all the time.
Yeah,
sounds really dumb.
That like is one that drives me crazy.
Like. Yeah.
If I catch myself saying like, if you like, I don't know, like, there's maybe like a way to like, oh, shut the fuck up. You know, if I catch myself over liking or overing, it's like the worst is, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's a rapper thing.
Yeah. Well, like we don't get any rappers in England.
You don't get rappers?
No,
you have rappers.
We don't have
over
proper
there.
Rappers,
how dare
though,
you?
Do we?
Scroobius
Pip. Proper ones.
You got
like Scroobius
Pip over there.
Do we?
How dare you?
Proves how in touch
Spin
I am with hip hop.
You should
I
get
remember
in touch.
Dougie Fresh.
Oh, my goodness.
Dougie Fresh, and I remember Dougie Fresh, and that's it.
What about
Roxanne?
Biggie?
Right, remember Roxanne?
What about Biggie?
Oh, Biggie was good. Yeah.
Come on, son. Good.
He was good.
Good?
Well, you know.
The greatest?
The greatest then.
Without a doubt.
The best ever.
The best that ever did it.
He was indeed, wasn't he?
He's the motherfucker right there.
What did he sing?
What
Put
did
one
he
of his
sing?
Records
he didn't
on
sing.
For me.
How dare you? Biggie, 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 can't you see?
Oh,
sometimes
no,
the words,
yes,
they hypnotize me.
No. I just listen to classical music.
Biggie, don't. Kick in the door, waving the 4-4. All you heard was Papa don't hit me no more.
You've missed your way.
You think I should have been a rapper?
I think you should.
I think you're a shitty mind coach if you really believe that.
Maybe we should swap.
Have you ever told someone that they should be doing something different? Have you ever told someone, hey, man, you need to fucking quit your job and become a rock and roll star or anything?
No. I've told people they shouldn't fight.
Really?
Yeah.
Because they're not good at it or because they take too much damage?
Because the coaches are shit.
Oh, okay.
We know that. You've seen fucking... Why, I've only had one fight, and I'm fighting B-class. In B-class in England, you can knee to the head. Oh, I'm fighting B-class. I'm like, it's not the best idea in the world. Mm. You say it nicely.
So you told them they shouldn't fight because their coaches were shit.
No, not coaches. Yeah, just it's a risk. You know, it's an early risk, and, you know, it's...
Well, why would you tell them that instead of telling them to get a better coach?
Yeah, you do.
You do?
Inadvertently. You just push them in the right direction. So then some people just, I don't know, some people shouldn't fight and never really put it together.
Well, you did what I do for the UFC, for It's Showtime, for many other kickboxing fights. And when you do that, you do see people that kind of don't have a chance.
Yeah.
You see a bunch of issues.
Yeah.
You know, like whatever it is, they're so far off where they need to be.
Yeah.
You're like,
God. It's car crash, isn't it? It's car crash TV sometimes.
Yeah.
It is. It's car crash TV, but like it's just part and parcel of what they do.
You did it again? You part and parcel
again?
I just
did it again.
Son of a bitch.
I'm sorry.
But like mismatches trouble me more than almost anything. And it's one of the things that I really like about MMA as opposed to boxing is boxing guys will get tune-up fights.
Well, what's that catch weight thing about? I don't get the catch weight thing.
Catch weight for MMA, it's usually because someone got a last-minute fight.
Right.
Or short-notice fight, and they don't want to cut all the weight. Right. Like, say if a guy fights at 155, like a Gleison Tebow, he fights at 155, but he really walks around about 185, and he cuts a lot of fucking weight. And so he has a process to cut that weight. And it's pretty scientific. They got to kind of stay with that process. Mm. And if they don't, like Benson Henderson, when he fought Brendan Thatch, Benson Henderson, former UFC lightweight champion, took a fight at 170 because it was a short-notice fight. Stepped in and fought at 170. And the reason why he fought at 170 is because, like, this way he wouldn't have to cut the weight, and he really wouldn't be able to take a short-notice fight at 155. It's just too hard to lose the weight. Like, they have to do it over a long period of time. Otherwise, they're significantly weakened. You know, they get down to a certain, you know, 10, 15 pounds away, and then they dehydrate themselves
down. Well, I get why, you know, when Cotto fought Daniel Gill a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
Why they made Daniel Gill way lighter, yet Cotto's got the middleweight title at 160. I didn't get that.
I don't know what they agreed to.
Yeah, they agreed to.
It was 154, right?
Yeah, something like that. And I just thought, eh? I didn't get it.
Well, no, maybe it's one strategy.
I think it was, I understand it's strategy and understand it's a business.
Mm-hmm.
But when was the days where that's what you weigh? That's what he weighs. He's the champion at that.
What did Gil weigh? Is he walking around a lighter weight? Is he a lighter guy?
No, he is a middleweight.
Right.
And I don't know if he's a big middleweight.
Well, maybe Cotto's thinking about fighting Floyd. And so he's working on fighting lighter and being lighter guys. And
yeah, but still, he's you
that's
know,
the big payday, right?
Indeed. But it's like 160.
Yeah. I mean, you know, he is the champ at 160.
Yeah.
And also, there's the Golovkin fight, which is 160, that he might be next in line for Golovkin. Yeah. Have they decided, is it going to be Cotto versus Canelo?
I think the big fight, because do you think that Cotto and Mayweather will sell? I don't think so. I don't know. But I think Canelo and Cotto is...
Canelo and Cotto is a big fight.
It's Puerto Rican versus Mexican. It's always big, isn't it?
They don't like each other for some strange reason.
They don't. So that'd be good. So,
they speak the same language. I don't get it.
Yeah, they do. I don't know. Who do you think would win? Canelo or Cotto?
It's hard to tell. Cotto certainly has taken more beatings.
Yeah.
You know,
I think Canelo's just got more weapons.
Yeah, well, he hits a lot harder. He's a scary fuck.
Yeah, he is.
You know, the Margarito fight, I think, took a lot out of Cotto.
Yeah.
That was a fucked up fight when you find out his history of loading up his wraps.
Yeah, Zab Judah fight was hard.
Yes.
You know, the Mosley fight wasn't easy.
No, it wasn't. You know? He's had some real hard fights.
Really has.
But the Margarito fight was fucked.
Yeah.
When you find out that he most likely loaded up his gloves with plaster. What does this say? Cotto Canelo, winner to fight Golovkin.
It's supposed to be maybe November right now. They haven't officially booked it.
Ooh, I'll see that. Fuck yeah. Cotto Canelo would be a great fighter, and a great fight, rather, and the winner fighting Golovkin would be giant. But nobody wants to fight Golovkin because only boxing fans know who Golovkin is. Yeah. Every Mexican on the planet knows who Canelo is.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of Spanish fans and boxing fans know who Canelo is.
We see him knock out Rubio with that left hook.
Mm-hmm. Like he's a motherfucker, dude.
Boom.
Yeah, he's a motherfucker. He hits very hard, but really, for me, it highlights my appreciation for Mayweather's technique. Yeah. I mean, say what you want about him as a human being. Mm. He seems to be, you know, a less than favorable human being.
Yeah.
But goddamn, as a boxer, he's magnificent.
You can't but admire his talent. He's
magnificent.
Incredible.
He's magnificent. I mean, he's the best ever, in my opinion. Mm. I don't think he's the most exciting ever. I don't think he's the most fan favorite. But it's the art of hitting and not getting hit. Who the fuck is better? You know, like, I had this conversation with Max Kellerman about it. He was like, Sugar Ray Robinson is so much better than him. I'm like, Sugar Ray Robinson lost to Jake LaMotta. You're telling me that Floyd Mayweather would lose to Jake LaMotta? I tell you, you're out of your fucking mind. I don't think Jake LaMotta would lay a glove on him. I think Floyd would be all over the fucking place. He'd be slipping to the left and slipping to the right and popping that jab and lead right hands and tying him up. And I just can't see him
It's always going to be the way, though, isn't it? Or if he fought him, he'd be blah, blah, blah. People are always going to have that.
They always do that. But I just think Sugar Ray took a lot of... He was an amazing fighter.
Yeah.
No, but it was a different era, different mentality, different style of fighting back then, different knowledge database. Yeah. People knew more about the effects of fighting
now. And sport evolves, doesn't it?
Yes.
Technique evolves.
Always will.
Yeah, definitely.
That's one of the most exciting things about MMA today is that you're seeing these guys, like these Yair Rodriguez's, these young kids that are coming up 23 years of age that have so many fucking tools. It's like you compare them to young people coming up 10, 15 years ago. Yeah. There's no comparison.
Yeah.
In MMA, it's a much larger jump than boxing.
We've got, on Infusion Live, we've got a couple of kids called Ilyas Belaide and Mohamed Jaroya, two Moroccans who train.
A lot of tough Moroccans, huh?
Mate, they can fight. They're Moroccan magic, I call it. They are just...
Badr Hari.
Oh, badass.
Bader's such a fucking psycho.
I've commentated on him loads and loads of times.
If that guy could just stay out of jail and stop breaking people's legs and shit.
Yeah. You know, he could just behave himself and stop being naughty.
Well, the reason why he's so good, though, is he's a fucking psycho. It's a part of the reason why he's so good.
He's mean. I'm not going to say anything derogatory about him because he might find me.
Well, the derogatory things that I'm saying are all positive. The psycho stuff is the reason why he's so fucking good. You know?
He's the most exciting kickboxer in the world.
But so aggressive.
Have a look at Jiroya and Ilyas Belaide. You can see them.
Is kickboxing at a higher level now than it was 20 years ago?
Yeah.
Much higher?
Yeah. I'd say the miles. Jiroya's 19. You know, Ilyas is... Jiroya's 19. Ilyas is 18. Jiroya's 18, sorry, and Ilyas is 19. Only young kids.
Wow.
But, like, they've had 110 fights. You know,
that's
insane. They fought, like, you know, amateur and,
with
shin pads on. But,
19,
you know, honestly,
100 fights.
Joe,
that's
they're
insane.
So nice kids. They're so nice. But getting in them rings and they just fight like fuck. And then when they get out, their treats like, hey, look, I had hamburgers and fries. I'm very happy. And you're like, you know, where other people are, like, celebrating and getting drunk and all that. They're just, oh, look, chips.
Wow.
You know? Wow, hooray.
Just keep them away from pussy.
I'm not
going to
stop.
That's how it starts.
Yeah, so it's just like,
That's how it starts,
but
partying.
They are the superb, really, really good kids, you know? It's just so fast and sharp and technique and everything.
Well, that's one of the things that perturbs me the most, or disturbs me the most about Glory. It's like, I see the level, like the Nicky Holtzkins and, you know, the high level of fighter.
Nicky Holtzkins got into boxing now, I think.
I don't know
if he's doing it as well or he's going into it, but I know he's boxed a few times now.
Really?
Yeah.
So he might become a boxer instead?
Maybe. I know he's doing it, though. And it's not really common for a Dutch fighter to go into boxing now. I think Tyron's dabbling with it, is he?
Yeah.
I think so as well. It's not really... Holland has not really got many boxers.
Well, Tyron fought his last fight because it was recovering from his broken leg that he got from Gokhan Saki.
Yeah.
Which is devastating. It's really rare, too, that you see a high-level kickboxer break his leg like that. That was unusual.
Yeah. But I remember him saying to me years ago at Showtime in Brussels, he said that he wanted to fight David Haye.
Ah.
He said, I want to fight David Haye. I want to do boxing. I want to fight David Haye. And he said that to me.
David Haye seems to me to be a really good fighter, but a little too small to beat a guy like Vladimir.
Yeah.
Like the Klitschkos, they're just fucking these giant guys.
Yeah.
He can't really reach them.
No.
You know?
No, he's fighting. I think Vladimir's next fight will be against Tyson Fury. Mm-hmm. Tyson Fury from England.
Yes.
Who's the funniest guy ever. His tweets are funny. And
yeah, he seems hilarious.
Oh, he makes piss.
Does he have a chance? Do you think he has a chance?
I hope so.
You hope so.
I don't know.
Well,
what I
thought was interesting about Vladimir Klitschko's last fight is that the referee was admonishing him for holding, and he was saying he was going to take a point away from him for holding.
Yeah.
That fucked his whole game up.
Yeah,
because his whole game was like pop that jab, pop that right hand, tie you up, wrestle.
Did you fight Povetkin?
Yes.
And that was like bop, mm-hmm. jab and grab and pushing him down and stuff.
That's his whole game.
Yeah.
And as soon as that goes away, then he's forced to stand with guys and trade and exchange. And, you know, he's been knocked out a few times.
Yeah. Will he do that against Fury? Because Fury's bigger than him.
Mm.
Fury's actually bigger than I hope Fury wins. He's from Manchester. He's from the same area as me. So.
Right. But that's just nationalism. If you take away that, objectively.
It's not easy.
Do you think you could beat him?
It's not easy.
Not easy. So not that's easy, a no. I'll say no. But he could.
He could.
Also,
because Vladimir's been, you know, who was the last person to knock him out? Was it Corey Sanders?
No, someone knocked him out after Corey Sanders, right?
What was his name?
I don't know.
I remember it at 4 o'clock in the morning for no reason.
Black guy, American.
Yeah.
Lamont
Brewster.
Yes, thank
that's
you.
Lamont
was he
Brewster.
He knocked him out after Corey, right?
Yeah.
So it was like two knockout losses in a row, wasn't it?
But you got to admit, they're just on it, aren't they? They're just consummate professionals.
Well, that's another Emmanuel Stewart success story. Emmanuel Stewart figured out how to get him to box right. And, you know, probably engineered that whole style that he's developed, too, this just pop and grab style.
Well, none of Emmanuel Stewart's were left hookers, were they? They were all long jab, right hands, you know, like Hearns. There wasn't really, like, big left hookers.
What about McCallum? Didn't McCallum fight under Emmanuel? Mike McCallum, the body snatcher?
Maybe.
Famous left hook to Donald Curry, left to the body and left upstairs.
Maybe, but was he with Hearns then? Was he with Emmanuel Stewart then?
I believe he was a cronk guy.
Yeah.
I believe McCallum.
Yeah, you're right, because there's a video of him sparring with McClellan.
Oh, with McClellan?
Yeah. That is classic. Mm. That's just... It was so amazing to watch. It's, you know, it's art, isn't it? It's real art. You know?
It really is an art, but it's also an art with a very short amount of time you could pursue it and a very limited number of times you can get hit.
Yeah.
You know, and I think...
It is a short existence.
That's one thing that used to disturb me most about MMA gyms, maybe say 10, 15 years ago, that these guys really didn't have, I shouldn't say these guys, some gyms really didn't have the best, most technical striking coaches that had a deep knowledge and understanding of striking. So these guys would be beating the fuck out of each other, just like throwing bombs at each other in the gym. You would watch it, and they weren't working on technique. They weren't sparring to get better at the art of hitting and not getting hit.
Yeah.
They were just wailing on each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was toughening them up, in quotes, air quotes. And then they would go into the gym or go into the ring and fight. And they were carrying all the damage that they were accumulating in these sparring sessions. And a lot of these guys now are kind of speaking up. Like Jamie Varner, who's a former WEC champion, top lightweight contender in the UFC, just recently retired. And he's talking about the amount of sparring that he did and how fucked up it was. Mm. Also, he was sparring with much larger guys. He was sparring with Ryan Bader, who fights at 205, and he's fighting at 55. And Ryan Bader's world class at 205, so he's fighting a guy 50 fucking pounds heavier than him. He's sparring him in the gym. It's madness.
It still takes its wear and tear, doesn't it?
Fuck yeah.
The kid just had his debut the last UFC that I think it was in Brazil, was it? I know, anyway. Darren Till.
Mm-hmm.
He's from just the same, lives on the same road as me. He lives in Brazil now, Darren Till. He's good, man. He's southpaw. He's a very, very good kid. Watch out for him.
There's a lot of good talent now. Yeah. This is an amazing time for MMA. I mean, this is such a young and blossoming sport. The level of striking is slowly and steadily getting faster and faster and better. It's really an amazing thing to watch. The jiu-jitsu is getting better. Everything's getting better. There's no comparison whatsoever. I mean, I don't know what the difference between 1993 kickboxing was. I mean, I know if you watch like Andy Hoog or Mike Bernardo, they were very good,
yeah.
but they're probably not as good as Badr Hari, right?
No.
But the difference between, say, fighters from UFC 1 and fighters of today, I mean, you're talking about a massive evolution, like generations of evolution, like 1,000 years of growth. It's amazing. There's no comparison whatsoever.
They're all learning very quickly from mistakes or what people have done before.
Learning very quickly and also accumulating the techniques from other disciplines, because a lot of the guys that started out, they're really only good at one thing. Either they're really good at striking or they're really good at grappling. That was basically it. But you're getting these guys today that are great at everything.
Yeah.
And that's just
it's more complete, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's a complete art. It was fragmented, wasn't it? When the first UFC started, it was fragmented with people doing jiu-jitsu. Pat Smith, was it? Was he?
Pat Smith?
Yeah, one of the first ones. And
yeah, he was devastating.
What's his name? The other one, the Dutch guy.
Which guy?
Orlando Viet.
Orlando Viet, Thai boxer.
I've seen him fight Thai boxing. I've seen him live twice. He was tough, him. Just unorthodox and...
Yeah, he was dangerous.
Yeah, same trainer as Ramon Dekker. Cole Hammers, who's with Glory now. He's the matchmaker for Glory. He trained him, yeah.
Yeah, he was an interesting guy early on in the beginning. Very, very good Thai boxer, but a good example of a guy who didn't know how to grapple. And he would get taken down to the ground and just smash.
Yeah, he got beat by a Dutch kid, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Like the elbow, wasn't it?
God damn it, what was his name?
Remco
Pardew.
That was it, yeah.
Yeah, Remco got him in a headlock, took him to the ground, and just blasted his brains out with elbows. I mean, he elbowed him like 4 or 5 times
Pat
while
Smith
he was unconscious.
That ninja guy. I had that on video. I used to watch it over. Mr. Make Me Laugh.
That was an important fight for people to realize that ninjutsu's bullshit. A lot of people really believed they were going to get in there.
Shuriken stars. Shut your stars
do
up.
Karate chops on people. Yeah, the level in comparison. Well, that's also one of the reasons why performance-enhancing drugs are so prevalent in MMA is because there's so many different things you have to work on. Like if you're a boxer, okay, what do you have to do? Well, if you do your road work, and then you're going to do your boxing work. You know, you do your sparring or your pad work. I mean, that's what you do. You spar X amount of days per week. The other days you're hitting pads and working the bag, doing your combinations, but you're only working on one skill. In MMA, you're not even just working on boxing when it comes to striking. You got to train elbows. You got to train kicks. You got to train knees. You got to train a different stance because you're worried about being taken down. So you have to work on your sprawl. You have to work on your takedown defense, underhooks, wizards, step away from the cage, how to get back up. Then you have to work on your jiu-jitsu. You have to work on sweeps. You have to work on actual submissions. And you have to figure out, like, how much can I do? Like,
yeah, and you have to get fit as well.
Exactly. Yeah. We see a guy like Cain Velasquez. You never see that guy attempt a submission. Never attempted a submission in all of his UFC fights because it's only so much shit you can do. So he takes guys down, he just beats them up, you know, instead of trying to, like, you know, learn all the chokes and all the... I mean, I'm sure he probably knows them, but applying them in an actual fight situation, it's almost like there's too much to learn.
Yeah, that's... When I went to UFC, when Ross Pearson fought Cole Miller, and then I realized how dangerous these guys are. You know, I thought, shit, they can just kick... You can get you on the floor and break your neck.
Yeah.
You know, and that tapping out is don't kill me.
Yes.
Basically, don't break my arm, don't break my leg, don't kill me.
Yeah.
And that's it's very it's reality, isn't it? It's real. It's real combat, isn't it?
It certainly is. Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why MMA has become so popular is because it's so difficult to go from that to like Floyd Mayweather versus Pacquiao, where it's like not much happens. There's like a lot of move, which I loved. I loved that fight. But the reality of the variables, like the different variables that exist in MMA, where a guy can take you down, a guy can kick your legs, a guy can do so many different things to you. You can't just stand in front of him and shoulder roll and box and then clinch. There's just so much more going on. The clinch is just the beginning. They're going to press you up against the cage. They're going to pull your ankles out from under you. They're going to mount you, elbow you to the face, going to cut you open. There's going to be a lot going on. It's not nearly as simple to defend yourself as it is in a boxing ring.
Yeah, it's true because, I mean, it's just like looking at them, they deserve the belt. To get that belt, the UFC belt, they must deserve it. Because the stuff they have to go through to get there, to, you know, to get where they want to get to is get where they want to get is... ridiculous.
Well, there's just a beat the fucking murderer's row that you have to go through to get to any shot at a title. It's like the guys you have to go through today, anybody that's fighting for a title today, like, fuck, man, you got to earn that. There's a goddamn massive group of contenders in every weight class that are dangerous as shit.
That's why you got to have the right mindset.
Yeah.
You've got to have the right mindset.
Do you anticipate that this mental training thing is going to be a part of every fighter's camp in the future?
I think it should be. Yeah, I think it should be, because you can get, you know, they can be in shape, they can, you know, the strength and conditioning, the right diet, and then if their heads are not right, their body doesn't perform.
Now, what about applying that to kids? What about applying that to kids in school? Not fighters, just people in school. I mean, especially in high school or in college, where you're about to go out into the world, and so much of your success or failure is predicated on your attitude, your mindset, and how your brain is organized.
Yeah, processing information.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is just, it's not really, it should be, there's so much stuff that you can do that can help people learn and take in information differently than just the cliche, read that, that's what you got to do, you know what I mean? That's why it's so interesting, because there's so many different types of people, different ways of thinking, you know, like we did earlier, we did the Hakalau, do you remember where we...
Yeah, why don't you explain what that is?
Hakalau is a slight... self-induced, all hypnosis is self-induced. Hakalau is a self-induced hypnosis thing where you basically find a spot on the wall that's higher than your eye line. So you imagine that you're looking through your middle of your eyebrows. And what you do is you focus on a spot on the wall. And you just allow yourself to just imagine that you can see all the way to the left and all the way to the right. You can imagine that you can see really high above yourself and below yourself. And then you can imagine that you can see 360 degrees. And what it does, it opens your periphery, opens your peripheral vision. So it gives you a slight hypnotic state and a more feeling of wellness in a way, you know, a relaxing feeling.
And what we did was you were telling me to concentrate on that spot and then visualize magnets.
Yeah, that was different. What we did was we did Hakalau first to kind of lead you into a hypnotic state, to get you to, because you don't go. You see these things on these rapid inductions, and I went on a course of rapid inductions where.
What is that?
Rapid inductions is a colour snap induction. So what they do is it's like you put it's like a shock. So you shock the system, you shock them. And then you go sleep or whatever, and it puts them under very quickly. You see it, you can see it on YouTube and all sorts of. I can do them. They're very showy techniques as well, but I don't really dig them.
Now, how does it work? Like shock induction? You're saying sleep?
Because your mind needs information. Your mind needs your unconscious needs information.
Mm-hmm.
So you can, like, there's one where you shake hands with someone. So when they go to shake your hand, you break the pattern and make them look at their own hand. And then you say, look at me, look at that. Focus on that. It's a confusion technique. And then you say, just focus on your hand and then push that hand together and head sleep. And they go under.
Just like that?
Yes, sir.
Why do they go under? Why don't they go, what the fuck are you doing with my hand, man?
Well, there's always that possibility. Hence me not doing it. I've seen it done. I have done it with people. But I've done it when I've been in therapy with the client already, because I talk in hypnotic language and do various things and stuff and just maneuver them into that state. So I don't really... You see people walking up on the street and these street hypnosis and all that, which is...
Street hypnosis?
Yeah, there's a few guys that do street hypnosis that are very good. Vince Lynch is very good.
Did he do it, like, television or something?
No, he was doing it in the street in Vegas. He was making people's hands stick to walls and...
What? Really?
Yeah. It's good, and it's... Have you never seen it?
No.
Oh, yeah, they do it. Yeah.
Street hypnosis. Yeah. I've seen street magic.
No, it's not street hypnosis.
Huh.
Yeah, so they make people forget their names or, you know, count, remove the number four. So they go 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. But it's fun to watch, but I not doesn't
Well, that doesn't interest you, because what you're trying to do is improve people. or help them improve
like
their lives.
He looks stupid.
Well, when I was a kid, when I was first starting out doing stand-up, there was a guy in Rhode Island named Frank Santos, and he was an R-rated hypnotist. And up until that point, I thought hypnosis was bullshit until I saw this guy over and over again, many times. He had a night once a week at Stitch's Comedy Club in Boston, so I saw him dozens and dozens of times. And he would hypnotize giant, and he knew when people were under and when they were bullshitting. He would get guys, he would look at them, and he'd go, no, you're not, this is not working, you're faking it. Come on. And he would take them off the stage. He knew when people were under, and he knew when they weren't. But he could get a whole group of people, maybe like bring 10 people on stage, and by the time he's done hypnotizing them, six or seven of them would be totally under. And he'd have them doing all kinds of ridiculous things, like they thought they were having sex, they would come in their pants. Like really
brilliant.
Amazing. I mean, I know for you, you're thinking, like, this isn't helping anyone. He wasn't trying to do that. He was trying to put on a show. Yeah. It was, you know, people paid to see it. It was fun.
Yeah, and if people are paid to see it and they want to go on stage, free will, no problem. I've done it before.
Part and parcel.
I said it again.
Son of a bitch.
It's that coffee. Blame the coffee.
Blame the coffee.
Well, anyway, sorry.
Don't worry about that, viewers.
So I don't dig that. It just doesn't do anything for me.
But how are they doing that?
Because if you go to a hypnotherapist and they say, you can't hypnotize me, then fuck off. Well, what did you come for? You know, what's the point? You know, you got a pizza to buy a pizza. You know, you want to come to see a hypnotherapist. You come to get hypnotized, you know? So you half go along with it anyway, you know? And it helps if the client's got an issue, they want to change, then they're more likely to change if they want to change with you, you know? But the people that do on the stage, they want it to happen to them. They don't mind looking daft, so that's cool. But what I did with you is we did the magnet as well. Which was just a stud way, because we did the peripheral vision. Then we just imagined that there was a magnet that could take negative energy from your body. And what that does is you use your own imagination to take the negative energy out. You do move. There's loads of weird stuff that...
But what is happening there, really? Because obviously there's no magnet, and your mind thinking that negative energy is being pulled out of your body. Is that just an adjustment of your attitude or an adjustment of your perceptions?
Who knows? But all I know is it works very, very well, and it's relaxing.
And is that related at all to what Frank Santos used to do by getting an entire group of people to think that they were doing wacky shit in front of an audience?
Because it's the installation of what? It's the installation that's different. You know, there was no magnet, as you said. They're not having sex. It's an installation. And
I didn't really think there was a magnet.
I know, of course, but they don't. They go on there for that experience, don't they?
Right.
They go on there for that experience. But, you know, it's irrespective of whether you believe there's a magnet or not. It's the end result if you feel more relaxed.
Right. It's almost like a placebo effect.
Indeed.
Right.
Yeah.
So the placebo effect, or the mind perceiving this change and then adjusting your attitude accordingly, that's what it is.
Yeah. It's about just redirection of thought. Redirection of focus.
But that was different than the hypnosis part, because the hypnosis part, when you hypnotized me, like, I was definitely hypnotized. Like, I definitely could I could listen to your voice, and I knew that I was hearing your voice, but I was in this weird sort of dream state.
Yeah.
I was aware of it, but not aware of it.
Yeah.
Like, if you took my pants off, we'd have a problem.
Yeah.
I would have woke up and go, what the fuck is this guy trying to pull? But you know what I'm saying?
Like, obviously he's trying to pull you.
I wasn't trying. But I wasn't, you know, it's a weird state, because you're not totally there, but you're kind of there.
Yeah.
Is that a good way of describing it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you're still there.
You're not going to do anything that's against your values anyway, really. You're not going to do anything. Well, like, we wouldn't anyway, because I'm not like that. I'm not like that as a hypnotherapist or as a mind coach. And what we did with you is we got you to focus on your thumb, that thumb. So we didn't say your thumb, that thumb. So you disassociate yourself instead of saying your thumb. He said that thumb. You focus on that thumb. And then you just get your focus on that. And then there was a structure, like, as you want to free yourself for it's good to do that. One, two, three, four. You know, so you're just like counting down as well.
No, do you...
Are counting up, but using numbers, you know?
Right.
So it's a cause a sort of... You're focusing on that. If you're focusing on that, then your unconscious mind, so you're focusing on that. And I'm talking to you with language that your unconscious mind recognizes to be relaxing.
Are you aware of the concept of like a Manchurian candidate?
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Have you ever watched Derren Brown?
Derren Brown, a hypnotist, right?
Derren Brown, yeah, he's a hypnotist, he's an entertainer, he's a magician as well. He's fantastic.
Yeah.
And he did one called The Experiments. I think you can watch some on YouTube. And he did one where they shot Stephen Fry. Stephen Fry's like a English comedian guy, and he's very posh, very, very, very intelligent guy, member of Mensa, but super smart.
Mm-hmm.
And they... he got this certain guy. They did a lot of elimination techniques, you know, to see who was most susceptible. And they used a certain guy to go and shoot Stephen Fry, you know, not with a real gun, obviously, but just whether, I don't know. I don't know. It's interesting. I don't know. There is a case where I watched when he assassinated someone and he said, definitely I was under hypnosis. And everybody's just saying that while he's in prison. I don't know, you know.
So do you think it's possible?
I
mean, you would know, right? Probably more than 99% of the people on the planet.
I think if it's against your deep level value, you won't do it.
But what if you're fairly shady but innocent?
Oh, it's darkness, Jews. That's very dark.
Right? I mean, if you find a guy who's not, maybe never killed anybody, but maybe he's done a few fucked up things, and you can talk that guy into doing something like that through hypnosis.
Yeah, possibly. Maybe.
Because you're essentially steering someone towards a crime that they ordinarily would have avoided.
Well, did you see this, again on YouTube, an Italian hypnotist and took money off the cashier. She got just took money out of the register.
No.
Yeah, they've done that. And Derren Brown played...
Did it on television?
No, he did it. It was captured on CCTV camera.
Oh, so he's a thief.
Yes. And there was one where Derren Brown paid with paper. So what he did is he gets paper, which is the same as, you know, like dollar bills.
Mm-hmm.
That's just blank paper. And there's a confusion technique. So he said, don't quote me on the script, but he said, I've just moved into the town, or I just got off the train, and I don't know whether to go that way or that way, because my friend said, you have to get the terrain, but I don't know whether to go that way or that way or that way. Mm-hmm. But do you know where the station is? But he said, get the train. He says, take it, it's fine. And then he said, well, just take it, it's fine. So that confuses the people, say, that way or that way. So it's mixed directing your thoughts. So he's moving his hands everywhere. She's thinking, what's this guy on about? Then he's saying, take it, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
So when he's giving the money, he's like, look, he said, oh, can I buy that? And he just gives them paper. And that's still confused. Not for long, because they soon come around and go, what the fuck are you doing? But he confuses them by saying, take it, it's fine. Take it, it's fine. So these...
Wow. I worked at a... like an ice cream place when I was a kid. They serve ice cream and hamburgers. This place mm-hmm. called Newport Creamery. And I remember they had someone came in that they called a flim flam artist,
right,
where someone would come in and they would give you $20 and they'd say, can you give me a 10, a 5, and 5 ones? And then they would say, okay, actually, can you give me a 10, 5, 5 ones, and 4 quarters? No, you know what? Give me two tens, and then they would start two tens, a five, and four quarters.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you'd have more than $20 that you'd be giving them for their money. And the manager closed the register. They went, hold on a second. What is going on here? And they shut the register, and they had like this sort of weird eye-to-eye moment with this guy who was trying to hustle this kid that was working the cash register. It was really fascinating. It was like a guy who was a con man. And I remember I was near it. I wasn't involved in it. Like I wasn't working on the cash register, but I was close to it. Forget what I was doing. But I remember watching this going, what is something happening here? And then they had like a little meeting. They explained, when you're working the cash register, you have to be careful of people that start asking you for weird things, asking you to, you know, because they start twisting your brain and confusing you, and your memory gets all fucked up, and you're trying to memorize what they're asking for, and before you know it, you've given someone $30 for $20.
Yeah, someone did that. I worked at a health club quite a few years ago, and a guy came in and he went, it's Frankin, who was the owner. I said, no. He said, oh, I've brought his chain for his wife. I mentioned his wife's name. okay, it's 20 quid. So I went, all right, give him 20 quid. That was it. And when he walked out, and then Frank come back and I said, you know, I paid for that, the repair of that, you know, bracelet. And what he'd done is he'd come in, he'd talk to someone at the back, who owns, who works, who's the manager, Frank. Where's your Frank? I'm sure I know Frank. What's his wife's name? Whatever her name was. And then Muppet at this end, Muppet at the reception. Hey, okay, here's the money. Anything else? You know, it was done to me. So,
so he gave you like a shitty chain.
Yeah, but I just went, oh, yeah.
And you gave him 20.
You know?
That's a weird hustle, that hustle of trying to confuse people. Mm. But there must be patterns that they try to tap into in the way people recognize money or the way people count things, that they try to disrupt and cause confusion.
Yeah, numbers, words, especially words, can confuse people and send them off guard. We did a thing when we did the Masters with Neurolinguistic Programming. We did a thing called Quantum Linguistics, which is really interesting. It's really cool. Makes you laugh. Doesn't make no sense. And one of the best language patterns, I was saying, when I was younger, I was always self-sabotaging. A guy called Chris Bannocks, who did my Masters with. And I said, imagine there's a wasp's nest and I've got a stick. Don't go near it because you'll get stung. But because I was young, I always thought, fuck it anyway, you'll get stung and just see what happens. I'll fight these wasps. Well, stupid.
Right.
You know, you're younger, you're daft, aren't you? And he said, what wouldn't happen if you pretended not to do it? So when he said, what wouldn't happen if you pretended not to do it?
Right.
And I was like, what? And it doesn't make sense.
No.
But it sends your mind in a, especially when you're in that sort of that. You know,
right,
say,
what
hey?
Wouldn't happen if you pretended not to do it? So if you pretend not to do it, but
you not
still
think?
Do
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
So if you're pretending not to do it, you're doing
it.
So what wouldn't happen?
Yeah.
Well, you wouldn't get stung.
What wouldn't happen is you
wouldn't get stung.
Yeah, but what wouldn't
so
happen
you would
if
get
you
stung.
Pretended not to do it? That's a sort of stone thing, isn't it? Mm. It's like, what wouldn't happen if
I'd be like, you need to learn how to talk better, motherfucker. You're talking crazy.
Yeah, but it's like in that situation where it's not like dropped on you, you know, you don't knock on top on the shoulder and say, hey, what would happen if you turn into it? In the cliche therapy thing and the parent therapy situation, when it's glided in with language, it works so smoothly.
Do you pay attention at all to cults? Do you pay attention at all? Because I'm fascinated by people's ability to control other people's minds and behavior.
Yeah.
And I've always wondered whether or not, like, when you see, like, have you seen the Scientology documentary, Going Clear?
I started watching it.
Oh, it's fucking fascinating, man. Yeah. I've watched it 3 times. I can't look away. I might watch it again.
Yeah.
I'll have to watch it. It's fucking crazy.
I'll have to watch it.
I've known several people that were Scientologists, but one of them was one of my neighbors. And, you know, he and I had some weird exchange about his wife was going clear, so he needed $50,000. I was like, what? 50 fucking grand. Like, whoa, what's going on? He was like, they're going to do some ceremony and his wife will no longer be influenced by outside pressure or, you know, outside thoughts or anybody's criticisms or negativity. They would no longer affect her. Mm. And they needed 50 grand for that. And I was like, what the fuck?
Right.
But he fucking, looking in his eye, he was telling me, like, oranges have vitamin C in them. You know, like,
for him, it was
pretty straightforward.
Obviously.
And I've always been fascinated, like, what the fuck is going on with
my
a cult?
My friend, named Aidan Piers, he was into Scientology. I don't know whether he still is. I don't think he is. But he went to FLAG, which is it the base where the Scientologists have, the main place where they have. And Tom Cruise's sister is named Aidan. Tom Cruise's sister's child is named Aidan after him.
Whoa.
So he was into it. I went to it a couple of times years and years ago, and I creeped me out a bit.
Mm.
But I'm not, I don't know if it, whatever floats your boat, if it's not causing you any, but I haven't seen that going clear, so I will do. I don't know about anything.
I agree with that as well. If it's not hurting you, and what do I give a fuck? I agree with that as well. Until you start watching these documentaries, you go, well, clearly it's hurting some people. It's definitely hurting people. It's breaking up families. It's really fucked up the way they attack some people that dissent or that leave. If the people that are on the show, the documentary, that are telling, if they're telling the truth, and that's debatable, only they know and the people that they're talking about know. there's some mind control going on there.
Yeah.
There's some absolute definite mind control going on there. And I wonder, is that related in any way to hypnosis? The ability that these people have to manipulate these folks into... Well,
look at Hitler's speech, Mein Kampf.
Right.
Look what Hitler did. You know, so people maybe are searching for something to be influenced. Do you know what I mean? So it's always going to be a lot easier, you know? So it's going to be... There's always going to be susceptible people.
There is always going to be susceptible people.
Yeah.
But is cult, like when you see like a Jim Jones speech or, you know, when someone is giving some sort of a cultish speech, is that similar in some ways to hypnosis?
It has to resonate, doesn't it?
Right.
It has to resonate with the people. I won't say it's hypnosis, but I just say it has to resonate with what they believe in and, you know, and what they... They floats the boat, I guess. You know what I mean? They can latch on to. It's like cold reading, isn't it? You know, yeah. Cold reading. Yeah.
What's that?
Psychics. You know.
Oh,
you
okay.
Say stuff like
cold reading and
cold,
acting. By
cold,
the way.
No. It's cold reading's a different thing.
It means
thing
you
altogether.
Get a script.
Yeah.
And you,
no, it's different.
I was trying to think.
No,
what is he talking about?
No, it's different. Cold reading's different. I went to Malta a couple of years ago. Was it Malta? No, it was Rhodes in Greece. Anyway, I digress. And we went over and we got stung by the timeshare people and anyway, the woman was going on to me and she said, what do you do in England? I said, I'm a psychic. She went, really? I went, yeah, I'm a psychic. She went, oh, right. I said, you had an accident near water, a scare maybe, before you was 10. I'm getting 10 for some reason. Before you was 10. And she went, yeah, you're right. Yeah, you did. You've got a scar on one of your knees. Yeah, I've got a scar on my left knee. I thought you did. Do you know what I mean? And you've had some limelight, but you don't mind other people, and you've had a lot of close friends. You've got a lot of friends, but you've only got a certain amount of close ones. So everyone resonates with that, like horoscopes. Everyone sort of like clings onto that, and you know, there's all sorts of, you know, psychics and people say, oh wow, they knew
this. That
stuff
drives me crazy.
Yeah,
I have a friend who believes that shit. He went to something. He's like, man, they told me all about my grandmother. I'm like, bitch, don't you know about your grandmother? They're telling you some shit you already know? What kind of psychic is that? That doesn't make any sense. And I never understood it until we had this guy. Do you know who Banachek is?
Yes.
I had Banachek on the sci-fi show that I did. Joe Rogan Questions Everything.
Yeah.
He was brilliant and stunning and scary.
Yeah.
Like, scary how good he is at it.
Yeah.
But also super honest. He's like, I'll tell you right now, I'm not a psychic.
Yeah.
I don't have any psychic ability at all.
Yeah.
This is all bullshit.
Yeah.
And I hate when people steal from people and rob them. What I'm doing is entertainment and it's a show.
Yeah.
And I have very specific techniques that I use to achieve this.
Yeah, that's why I can't think of anything else. That's why I don't fuck around when I do hypnosis and do this and do nothing.
Right.
No.
Well,
it's
he
just
wasn't
not the game, is it?
He wasn't doing hypnosis. He was just pretending to be able to read your mind and be able to put it was all. But he was really, really clear about it, saying these are just techniques.
Yeah.
I am not really seeing anything that other people can't see. I don't have any special ability. But the people that do claim that, like, I don't know how it is in England, but in California in particular, you'll drive down the street and you'll see four or five of these fucking psychic readings.
Chiropractors and that. There's loads of chiropractors as well. There's loads in America.
Is chiropractic bullshit? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying it is. There's loads of chiropractors. And you see that tarot, and you're driving on the street, and chiropractors, you don't see that many in England.
A lot of people think chiropractors are bullshit, too.
Mm.
It's like a lot of reputable people think it's bullshit.
Right.
They're just moving your neck around. And it's
click,
like,
click, and click. I'm cured.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it costs a lot of money, too. You go $150 and they just
twist it around,
popping your back. But
right.
Then some people say, like, there's certain things that chiropractors do that really are beneficial. Yeah. So who the fuck do you believe?
Yeah, the ones I've been to a couple of times when I've been here, because I've not been to one, they've been good. So I felt all right afterwards. So.
Well, there's this one guy that used to work with a lot of fighters, and he was what they call a zone healer. And his idea was that he was, like, sort of tricking your body into healing because he was sort of using the placebo effect, telling you that he was healing you by popping your neck or moving your body in a certain way. But he really wasn't doing anything other than shit a normal chiropractor
does. Is he
still
working?
I don't know. I try not to pay attention to that shit. That stuff drives me nuts because it's deception.
Yeah.
And whether or not it's effective or not is debatable because deception can be effective, right?
Yeah.
And isn't that sort of part of what...
Yeah.
you know, what the placebo effect
exactly.
is.
Exactly. This is what I'm against in the hypnosis thing, really, is what the point I was trying to make is I don't fuck around with people.
Right.
You know, they come to you for help. They genuinely want your help. Mm-hmm. They genuinely want to get where they want to get to, and you can't fuck around with people.
Right.
It's not fair. They pay you, and they're looking for you to help them out. I buzz off it, because then you achieve something together. You know, mm-hmm. It's good. I like that. But, yeah, there's a lot of shit in everything, though, isn't there?
There's a lot of
crap. There's more shocking chefs than good ones, you know what I mean?
And isn't that... There's also a lot... There's a lot of manipulation and a lot of charlatans mm-hmm. in almost every yeah. line of work,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
But isn't that... It's sort of it's relative to what we're talking about. It's like, what is your focus? Like, what are you trying to achieve? Mm. What are you trying to achieve as a coach?
Yeah.
As a coach, you're trying to help people and make them better. What are you trying to achieve as whatever you're doing, as a salesperson?
Yeah.
Are you trying to sell people something that's an actual great product, like a mm-hmm. really nice car?
Yeah.
Like, this is a car. If you enjoy cars, you will enjoy this car. It's great. Or are you selling them a fucking shit box that's been taped together and it's going to fall apart the moment they get it out of the driveway?
Mm.
You know, what is your ultimate goal? Are you trying to help people? Are you trying to have a beneficial, mutually agreeable relationship? Or are you trying to read their palm and get money out of them?
Yeah.
Are you fucking with them?
Or aren't I amazing, Cynthia?
Yeah.
I'm fucking amazing. Like, I never, you know, like the success that Joe's had.
Joe Schilling?
Yeah. And the success that many of my clients have had. I don't go, it was me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because... It's all about the client. They do it. I like winning, and of course, there's some sort of pat on the back for myself by me. But I don't run around and go, "Aren't I amazing?" Because
but is
at
it
the
a
end
pat
the
on
day,
the back, or is it just an appreciation for the method?
Appreciation of the method, and appreciate. You know, it doesn't stop shocking me how well it works at times. You know, well, 99.9% of the time, it's just the shock. Even now that I've been involved in it 8 years now. It's just, I don't know, I buzz off it. You can tell I buzz off it and stop jumping
yeah.
around about it.
How many years have you been doing it full-time?
Eight? No, I'm half and half.
But training as well, training fighters?
I was training fighters. I got kind of bored with it. I'd achieved what I wanted to. My fighters had reached a level. I was getting bored, and I wasn't giving them the attention I should do. So I decided to stop that, and then I had a regular job anyway, and then I just started to get mind coaching and word of mouth. Like, you got to know me through word of mouth, and then it's just spread from there, and it continues to do so.
So now that's
still
full
commentate.
Time?
I still commentate as well. I commentate for Infusion and from Yokao, Muay Thai shows, and Smash Muay Thai as well. It's in England, which is good shows, and I still do that. You know, I've done GFC and, you know, different things like that, but I still commentate a lot for Yokao and Infusion and Smash Muay Thai, and just do that as well. But I've got a lot of clients from America now, which I'm up at stupid o'clock in the morning, you know, doing it on Skype, but it's great.
Yeah, was there an 8 hour or 10 hour yeah, difference between us?
Something like that, I don't mind.
Something nutty.
I buzz off it. I genuinely buzz off it. I like it.
Well, that's great. I mean, that's really what life is all about, finding something that you really enjoy, that you get that buzz yeah. off of, and pursuing that, and if you can make a living
well,
at
you're
that.
The same, aren't you? You can tell you're animated by what you do.
Yeah. Well, I'm just super lucky that yeah. I found a bunch of different things that yeah. I really enjoy doing. Like
you're
just this.
And that you're good at as well.
Well, how about this? I mean, the ability or the opportunity, rather, to have a conversation like this with yeah. a guy like you, sit down for hours, totally uninterrupted. It's very rare to get this. It's almost like the only way to get these kind of conversations
yeah.
is to have this kind of conversation where you know it's being broadcast. Because yeah. otherwise, we'd be checking our phone. We'd be talking, you know, do you want a beer? Do you want this and that? Oh, this fucking guy is annoying, and this thing is happening to me. And
keep
I gotta...
saying part and parcel all the time.
You wouldn't. You know, you probably wouldn't do that.
You wouldn't notice it.
But you know what I mean? Like, this is the only way you have these intense one-on-one conversations is in a podcast form.
Yeah.
So in a lot of ways, this podcast has been incredibly educational. It's yeah. been like this, like a almost like a very varied university course mm-hmm. on a bunch of different disciplines
it's
and interests.
What I appreciate is, like, you know, you said about Mike McCollum and the left hook, and I mm-hmm. like that. You know, and I went, oh yeah, I forgot about him. And that. Mm. I'm not egotistical enough to think I know everything. You know, I don't. There's a lot of them. I seen, like I said, a rapid induction course, and the guy was just like, he was doing this hypnosis gun, and he's going sleep, and this other guy was going
Right, but isn't that similar, like that fucking those bullshit kung fu guys? They're like, and their students fall to the ground.
I can do.
Don't you think that's that hypnosis too? What is going on with
bullshit.
That? It is bullshit,
idiots.
Right?
But it's just idiots. Is it just? I don't think.
What's
it's
happening with the students?
Because they're pricks.
The students, though, they're falling to the ground. They're twitching.
Yeah, but they're just daft, aren't they?
You know, but are they, or are they under the hypnosis power of suggestion?
No, I don't think it's nothing to do with it. Yeah, you know, maybe it's a suggestion, or maybe it's just they're not all there. There is a lot of weird people about, isn't there, Joe? You know,
you're going to say idiots, and you went with weird.
I kind of switched it in the middle, changed the trajectory of the rocket that would have got me in trouble.
That is the problem, right? Like, some people have big noses, and some people are idiots.
Some people have got gray hair, and some people haven't.
Yeah, it's like the genetics vary. There's not everybody could be Einstein.
No.
And some people, you go, ha, and they fall to the ground.
I mean, it'd be good, though, wouldn't it?
I've seen some videos of fake kung fu, and it's fucking amazing. Like, there's this one dude, and he was teaching this class, and he had this girl, and he was moving her back and forth and back and forth like a comedy.
Yeah.
Like, it was a comedy, but it was real. And he, you know, he'd make her dance and shock her, and then she would fall to the ground, and she's...
Have you seen the recent one there? That guy like gets his student. He's like a big bellied guy with his gi on, and then she does this, and he goes, "Give him an Oscar." That was a right performance. He just like flops on the deck, and his arm flew in the air. That was proper funny. Because I'm here at the moment in America with Jordan Watson, who's a superstar in Muay Thai, and we was watching it. We was pissing ourselves laughing. It was funny.
Well, there's a lot of that out there, man. There's a lot of that fake kung fu stuff out there. Less and less now than there was in 1993 when the UFC came along. That's one of the things that the UFC has done that's amazing is eradicate a lot of the bullshit martial arts. Yeah. There's a lot of fake practitioners out there. And, you know, Eddie Bravo has this hilarious story of this fake kung fu teacher that he was taking lessons under. You know, he was a young kid. He didn't know any better. And the guy was going to China to study under his master. And Eddie ran into him at the supermarket when the guy was supposed to be in China. He's like, "The fuck is going on?" And then he realized this guy isn't taking kung fu. He's just making shit up. Like, everything he was doing was just totally made up. You know, like, he was karate chopping people on the top of the head and saying you'd kill them if you hit them correctly. Like, but it's that sort of McDojo type fake martial arts stuff was really, really, really prevalent a few decades ago.
Yeah, but I grew up with Drunken Master.
Drunken Master
and all them. And
oh, yeah.
All the Run Run Shaw movies, you know, Golden Harvest. I love that.
Well, those are fun to watch, to pretend. Yeah. You know, you watch an old Jackie Chan movie and he's fucking and all that crazy shit. But the
Drunken Master's the one.
Yeah.
He's beating him up with a tea towel. Sam Seed. It's funny.
Well, it's a comedy, though. It seems funny.
Yeah, but it's still there. And I tell you what, I really like Police Story with Jackie Chan, the first one. That was good. That was wicked, that was. He's mad, Jackie Chan, isn't he?
But a lot of those movies had people believing that there were people out there that had chi and death touch and, you know? When you watch, I mean, to bring it back to what you do, Do you think there's any of that that's hypnosis? Is there anything that's similar to like what I said Frank Santos used to be able to do?
I don't know.
Is it
honestly? I don't know.
Devotion that they have towards their sensei or their
It's bananas, aren't they?
They're just fucking crazy.
Yeah, they believe what he says, so they're like, "Oh yeah, he can do this." And
but how is that different than a guy who thinks like I watched a guy who thought he was having sex with Madonna and he came in his pants. Because Frank Santos put that in his head, and he did that. I watched it. Yeah. And the guy was like, he didn't know. He came in his... I mean, this guy wasn't that good of an actor. He just wasn't. He was embarrassed. He didn't know what to do. And he kind of, like, slunked over and sat in the corner. If he was a ham, he would have spent... It just was... You could tell this guy really believed that.
At that particular time, where he was at that particular... In that particular place, he did believe it. I mean, you've seen people with... needles, and they have a needle through the hand, and they don't feel the pain. You can do that. There's an interesting one called Pain Paradigm, which I'll talk to you about another time. And
anticipation.
There you go. Next week, viewers. And there's all sorts of things that we who knows what the mind's capable of. We're only just. You know, I'm only a postman of information, really. I mean, what really can we do? What will you develop with?
That's an interesting way to describe it, a postman of information.
Yeah, that's what Keith Mayer, my first teacher, said. Mm. We're just postmen of information.
I like that.
Yeah.
I'm really fascinated by the full spectrum, for lack of a better term, of possibilities of suggestion that you can go from, you know, fake psychics and fake healers and like... My friend Brian and I were at the Comedy Store last night. Did you see that? Were you there when you saw the woman was trying to do the Reiki healing on us? It was hilarious because I knew I was going to talk to you today, and I knew she's full of shit.
Yeah,
and she was, or she probably thinks it's real, but she was like, "Can you feel the energy? I'm like waving." Like she said, "Put your left hand out because left hands are more sensitive, more susceptible." I'm like, okay, so I have my hand out, and she is like. Running her hand over the top and the bottom, like not touching my hand, but getting close to it. Like, do you feel it? Do you feel anything? And I'm like, nope, I'm trying to be open-minded, but I don't feel anything. But some people would be like, yes, I do feel
it's,
it.
I think it's what you want to believe. Yeah. And I think my beliefs, like people that are psychics, and you go to see these tarot card readers, etc. If they give people comfort and make some people feel better, then, you know,
right.
Got more power to him.
Right, more power to him.
You know, if
them.
They believe it, half the time, if they believe that there is Reiki, I don't know, and then if they believe it and it works and people are happy doing it, I mean, we might go, but it's, you know.
But where's the line drawn? Is the line drawn when you're taking money from them?
There is piss takers in the world, isn't there? Piss takers.
What is
that? You know, taking the piss.
Well, okay, you guys are fucking with somebody.
Yeah, fucking with someone, yeah. Okay. Taking the piss.
Yeah.
Piss takers.
Yeah, but more so than that, someone who, like, is pretending to be healing, but they're stealing money from you. They're not really healing you.
Yeah. Well, it's like anyone that sells, a vitamin that have this.
Right, snake oil.
Snake oil, yeah, of right. course. Snake oil, oh, take this and you'll definitely change.
But what about fucking the real placebo effect? That's where it gets really weird because, like, there are some placebos that they have introduced to people and they've told them it's a placebo.
Yeah.
And then but the act of doing something, the act of taking something actually has a more beneficial effect than not doing anything.
Yeah.
Which is... Again, the power of the mind. Like, the placebo effect is a real effect. You give someone something, you tell them this is medicine. Mm. This is going to fix whatever ails you. And it actually does work on a certain percentage, a statistically significant percentage of the people
amulets
it actually
work
works.
The same, don't they?
Amulets, right. Like amulets. Crystals and shit.
Yeah, amulets work the same. Right. It's like a lot of Thai people believe in. They put a Buddha on and it
or even good luck, right? A good luck coin.
Yeah.
I got anything. My lucky quarter.
Oh, Dumbo, isn't it? You know, the feather, lucky feather.
Right.
You know, when he believes he can fly with the lucky feather, it comes out.
Right.
All that, you know, the rest. Yeah, I think it's all down to you, isn't it? It's all down of what you put into your intention and what you want to believe for yourself, you know?
But isn't it weird that we have these minds that have such amazing potential, but there's no fucking real good guidebook that anybody's handed?
No.
And you're sort of supposed to figure it out on your own or based on, if you're lucky, you have parents that have their shit together and they sort of give you a rough outline of how you should live your life or live by example. But we're not talking about, like, goldfish or swans or anything fucking simple. We're talking about human beings with complex languages and mathematics and culture and society and laws and money and all the weirdness that comes with being a person. And
good, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's good, though.
It is.
That's why it's so exciting.
Well, that is how exciting.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm from a bloodline of Merlin and Sherlock.
Yes.
And Merlin Holmes.
There you go.
Sounds like real estate. But I just like that. Mm-hmm. I like that. I like the mystery.
I do too.
I like them.
Yeah.
Because I can see you probably think, I like that. That's interesting. And that's what keeps you going in life, I think. When you find something interesting and you're trying to, you know, it's always better to be interested instead of interesting.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's one of the things that I appreciate most about being able to do this podcast is that I'm constantly and consistently inspired and curious. I'm always learning. Like, you can't know everything. It is not possible. There is too much going on.
Yeah.
And once you accept that, then you're just looking for stuff that you find stimulating.
Yeah.
And then find more and more things that you find fascinating.
Yeah.
And this podcast has given me this really unique opportunity to talk to people like
you
or, you know, anybody who has some information that I'm not really aware of.
I'm massively honored to be on air because, you know, I'm just from Liverpool.
I'm from Newton.
Yeah, I know, but, you know, I'm just like, you know, but, you know, but he's coming in here and then Joe says so nice things, Ian McCall says nice things, mm-hmm. and I get to do seminars and get to meet people, and I love it. I'm just buzzing off it at the moment.
Well, that's what life is all about, really, is finding something like that, that you really enjoy doing and then pursuing it, and then if you can, God, if you can make a living doing that, what a great way to be, you know?
Yeah, I like people. I like, you know, I like people. Like, I don't take everyone on as a client because some people just think, no.
Right.
No. You best go somewhere else.
Have you had, like, people that are, like, shitty or just not appreciative?
I kind of sussed them out quickly.
Do you try to explain to them why you're not doing this and maybe you give them, like, some help for the future?
I just say, well, I can't or I'm busy or just the normal stuff and, you know, or... Depends on what it is. It's not often. I'll be honest with you. It's not often that happens. But, yeah, it does happen. I just kind of deter them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's one guy recently. He's like, yeah, everyone in my team thinks I'm rubbish. I can't fight and I can't talk to you now. My wife's in bed. And just like, oh, all right. You know, just loads of things
right.
in this way. I just thought, no.
That's too much work. Like, if you can't,
too much hassle.
No sovereignty.
No, it's too much hassle.
Yeah.
But I like underdogs triumphing. I like that. Even at a gym, I had, you know, people that didn't win fights under other gyms and they won under me. I like that.
Mm.
It's just good to, I don't know, just to give them that buzz and you feel good about yourself. Think, yes, I've achieved something that other people didn't. I like that.
Right. Yeah, the ability to help people and the satisfaction that comes from other people benefiting from your effort is a very nice thing.
Yeah, I had a lady, it's an equestrian lady called Donna Tainter at the minute. She's, I forgot where she is, somewhere in the States, and she's doing really well. It's just, the transformation has been incredible, and she's, you know, all her students are so much better, her sponsors are like really warming to her, she's riding better and stuff like that. And it's just moving things out of people's way. It's kicking out.
All right, so if people want to get a hold of you, what is the best way? Your Twitter handle is Vinny Shorman. What is it?
Vinny Showtime 69. The reason why it's called Showtime, it's not perverted in 69. Showtime is, I used to be a commentator for it.
Showtime.
And 69 was the year I was born. So.
Oh.
No, yeah, nothing perverted.
That's
there.
A problem, right?
That's
isn't
funny.
It? That number, 69.
Yeah, I'm going to have to change that, I think.
Well, it's a lot of great cars from 1969.
Yes. And it's when they landed on the moon.
Yeah,
And you can get me on vinnyshorman.com, and also you can get me on Facebook. There's a Facebook of mine coaching page where there's techniques and videos, withdrawal techniques and all sorts of stuff.
Beautiful. It was a pleasure. I really appreciate
Thank
this,
you,
man.
Joe, really
Let's do this again
it.
Sometime. How often are you in California?
I'll be back very soon because Liam Harrison's fighting Malai Pet and Andy Housen's fighting Romy Adanza, and I'm coming over with them.
When is that?
July the 31st, the fight is, so I'll be over before.
Where's that taking place?
I'm not too sure.
It's somewhere in California?
Somewhere in Cali, yeah.
Really? Okay,
yeah.
Maybe I'll go to the fights.
Oh, I'd like to see that.
That sounds awesome.
Definitely. All right. That'd be great.
Beautiful. Thank you, Vinny.
Thanks
really,
a lot,
really
Joe.
Appreciate it.
Thank you
fun.
Very much indeed. Cheers.
All right, friends. We'll be back next week. Lots of great and entertaining guests. Not as entertaining as this motherfucker, but we'll try. See you soon.